Ahoy, mateys! Welcome to the second part of this week's GameBuoy.org video game podcast. I'm your host, Captain Spike. With me, as always, is First Mate Slagkick.
Arr!
And with us this week is Rob Roberts, who is allowing us to record in the Orange Lounge Radio... Lounge Radio? And Tim from Crystal D, whom we'd like to welcome to the SS Game Buoy family presently.
Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing well. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for crashing our studio.
It's fun. Excellent.
You crashed the SS Game Buoy into the OLR studios.
You really are pirates. You threatened to pillage the village unless you could record a show here.
Oh, brilliant.
We're going to tell you all about why these guys are awesome in just a second, but let's get this official. Today is July 28th, 2013, and you're listening to the B-side of Episode 33, Through the Fire and Flames, a look at the highs and lows of rhythm gaming. Getting back to our two guests this week, Rob Roberts is a superstar and the closest thing to a celebrity that I know.
Whatever.
You probably know him from such shows as Orange Lounge Radio and Horde House. Rob, why don't you tell our beautiful listeners out there in Internet Radio Land a little bit about yourself?
I think you kind of hit it on the head there. I co-host a very long-running, in fact, we believe it is the longest-running video game podcast on the Internet, our weekly game show, Orange Lounge Radio, which has just hit 11 years this June.
11 years. Congratulations. 11 years.
Congratulations. Mark!
Every Sunday night, and it's a lot of fun. And then, that kind of led, throughout the years, Orange Lounge Radio was once its own station on Live 365. Then we were affiliated with one network called All Games, and now we're on, the Voice of Geeks Network, VogNetwork.com. And through that long history, we've had all these different spinoff shows that have come from that. And Horde House, in a way, is one of those spinoff shows. And our little tagline we like to say is, all things online gaming, but never too seriously. Believe it or not, Horde House has been around for about 2.5 years now at this point.
Really?
Yeah, it's up to about 115 episodes when it was getting a little spotty there because, we were Warcraft dedicated for a while. But like a lot of people, we haven't played a lot of Warcraft lately, so it's more all online games to include things like Final Fantasy 14, Guild Wars 2, and the other games that people are playing right now. League of Legends is huge, too, obviously.
Is anyone over there playing Shin Megami Tensei Imagine?
I don't think so. Not at this point. You'll have to suggest that to Extifer. He's our resident game reviewer there now.
Oh, excellent. I want to tell me, Slagkick, did you start Fabulous Flames around the same time period as Horde House?
No, it was a little bit after.
So you guys wouldn't be 2.5 years old at this point.
No, no.
The world weeps for that.
I was just going to say, I want Extifer to review one of those games that you see the ads for where it's got the naked women. And it's build your empire.
You mean or we should just have Extifer review X-rated games? Custer's Revenge, Beat 'em and Eat 'em, things like that.
Why didn't we have him on our adult gaming episode?
I didn't you? I don't think he's actually played a lot of those games.
That would have been
I'm surprised.
Best,
but I am here for Miss Nude World 96. That was the best of the adult games.
Well, Rob, since I've actually played that game with you, this might be a really good way for me to get in, sort of. I've known you for many, many years. Would you
it's
like to tell? Pardon?
I was going
to
say, it's been a while, it has.
Yeah.
Too long, in fact. No, I'm kidding.
Both
probably
gray
right
over there.
Would you like to tell our listeners a little bit about how we met?
That's secret. No, it's cool. We met on the internet. How do people meet these days? It's all internet. You and I were friends on a gay gamers forum called, what was it, Gamers Experimentations or something like that?
That was Gamers Experimentations, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't even remember how I found that. I think I was just maybe searching out gay gamer groups one day. And this is before Facebook. We were all on LiveJournal. Even MySpace probably predates that.
Friendster.
They would have these parties. The gay gamer group would have these parties, and we went to one G-rated parties. Y'all, get your mind out of the gutter.
G-rated,
very G-rated.
Say it now.
Not even PG.
So I went to one of these parties in the Bay Area, and I actually brought Extifer. You would have met Extifer for the first time that night too, and Irene. Some people know her as Princess Irene from the OLR and those shows. We all went to one of these parties, and I met you there. And I don't know. We just clicked. We hit it off with our mutual nerddom and. And we've been frenzies ever since. Wasn't that 8 or 9 years ago? It was a while ago.
Must have been 8 or 9 years ago now, yeah.
Yeah. Not to get too ahead of ourselves, but I know the big game we were all playing that night was Karaoke Revolution, the first one.
Yes, the very first one.
Because Extifer is a huge karaoke whore, if you meet him. He loves that
also
stuff.
Also just a huge whore.
Now, he's settled down now. He's can't say that.
Funny story about that. I actually went out and bought Karaoke Revolution the next day after that party.
Did you?
And then immediately had people over at my apartment for that, like, that night.
Yeah.
Yeah. You used to have some pretty epic rock band and music game parties at your place. Again, I'm getting ahead of ourselves, but deal with it.
Indeed. Well, I want to know, this is a question that I sort of ask everybody that comes on the show. What is your favorite game? Or, you know, ideally maybe your favorite left-of-center game that maybe our listeners have never heard of before.
Okay, well, I'll give you a little bit of both, because my favorite game of all time, without fail, is Super Metroid, right? I mean, that's, you have to say that. If you don't say Super Metroid, what is wrong with you? I'm just kidding. But I get in fights with co-hosts on Voice of Geeks Network. Play fights. They're not real, but over that stuff all the time. But yeah, Super Metroid is my favorite game. I mean,
it's a good choice.
Oh, God. It's just so... The replayability, the music, the speed running, and all this, it's just great. Okay, so I thought, like, what would be like a left-of-center game that maybe not even Captain Spike would know about? And I don't know if I can do this, because you know everything. I swear, you know more about games than I do some days, I'm pretty sure. Okay, but here's the thing. So I was pretty much born and raised not so much on Nintendo or Atari 2600, although I did adore both the 2600 and the Nintendo. In the between time from about the age 5 to about age 10, I loved my Commodore 64. Is the best, right?
Are we going to talk about Alice in Wonderland, Below the Roots, or Hero?
No, I want to talk about a game called Lazy Jones. Have you ever played this game?
I haven't.
Yes! Okay, Lazy Jones on the Commodore 64, I used to play this game all the time. And I think I covered this on OLR once during the Classic Game of the Week, like a long time ago when Darksakura was out. But Lazy Jones was basically WarioWare. But, like, before there was, you know, that whole thing. So the thing takes place in a hotel, and you play this guy that's, like, walking around and goes in the different rooms, and the different rooms are all little meta mini games. And so you try to get the score as fast as you can in this little game. Like, one of them might be a little mini breakout game. There's another one that kind of reminded me of Puyan, where, like, you're in the elevator that goes up and down, you shoot balloons, and that whole thing. They actually had, that might have been the game that was actually called 99 Red Balloons. Actually had that. But it was also really well known for its music. Its music kicked ass, like, because obviously the Commodore 64 chiptune was all awesome. So I believe there was a dance song later on that sampled Lazy Jones.
Wow.
Yes. So you got to look up, like, a little YouTube. There's got to be a YouTube out there, somebody playing this game or something. And the soundtrack's great. And, you know, it was a game that was ahead of its time in many ways. And so... There you go, Spike. I thought of the most outside-the-box game that I loved growing up. So there you go, Lazy Jones.
For Commodore the first 64. Time on air, I am literally speechless. Well played.
Thank you.
And, you know, you've already done a little bit of plugging, but before we move on to our next guest, did you want to plug either of your shows?
Absolutely. I'll always take a chance, take a cheap plug. Orange Launch Radio, of course, and all these shows are available on iTunes and so forth. And Horde House and Orange Launch Radio, we say, is the show where every gamer has a voice. And we all met, myself, Dark Soccer, and Loki, playing Dance Dance Revolution at the local arcade. And, you know, there used to be a big community around DDR, and I'm sure we'll get into that later. But DDR was such a community. You know, we wanted to be kind of the hub of that, because after you play DDR at the arcade, you go to a restaurant to, you know, eat together, and you just kind of sit around the table and talk smack about games and whatever else. And that's kind of the essence that we wanted to bring to that show. So now we use the internet as an extension of that. Our table expands internationally thanks to Skype, thanks to chat, and so forth. And then Horde House, of course, is a little more risque. It's kind of like the burlesque online podcast, but it's a lot of fun. And, you know, it's just, if you like to hear four guys sit down and be bitchy to each other, you can either listen to what we're doing right now, or you can listen to Horde House later on. And I would, of course, have to plug the Voice of Geeks Network, which is kind of the hub for these shows and other fantastic shows and other original geek content. That's vognetwork.com. That's VOG. vognetwork.com. And the really cool thing about Vogue Network, which I love, it is also like a social game. So you visit the site, you can get loot, you know, the comments, the participation is rewarded with little virtual currency, which you might be thinking like, well, what is that even good for? But then I go like, well, people use like Get Glue and get the stickers. They don't mean anything, or they get four square badges. That doesn't mean anything.
People are really into like gamifying anything. So I think it's really clever that for something with so much gaming content, that you went that route.
Thank you. We do try to be more than just gaming content, but absolutely, I mean, that's always going to be, for me anyway, that's always going to be the cornerstone. That's why we had to bring other people in, and we have such talented people like Pod Culture. You know, they know a lot about like Doctor Who and the sci-fi TV. You know, they're really good. Girls Gone Wow, you know, International, and they are a very lovely bunch and kind of bring a great female perspective to the network, which is amazing. And, you know, so many great anime jam session. I could go on and on. But
and you have.
Yes, I have. I'm sorry. That was a really big plug, but I just get really excited when I talk about Vogue Network.
Well, I'm happy you've relieved yourself of your big plug.
Whoa!
Shade.
But no, in truth, you know, this is exactly why you were my main, like, target guest, the person whom I really wanted to have for this episode. I cannot think of a single person whom I know that is better able to speak about the impact that rhythm gaming had on gaming culture in its heyday. So I'm super pleased.
Are you sure
him.
Like Jason Enos or Naoki would have been a better choice?
Okay. This is Game Buoy.
All right.
We do the best with what we got, but what we got is not much.
Yeah, girl, we're not Retronauts. We don't have a Kickstarter.
Okay, I should. Fared. Kickstarter for $35,000. I'll do something I already do for free, uh-huh. And any more than that, and we'll fly Naoki out, and it'll be all good.
Okay, it'll be all good. No, I appreciate that you guys have me on, finally. I've been begging for weeks and weeks. No, it's cool.
You thirsty girl.
I know, I am. I'm very first thirsty for Game Buoy.
Let's move this forward a little bit. I'm going to let First Mate Slagkick take Tim, who has actually played these games in Japan.
So, Tim, why don't we talk about your gaming history a little bit?
My gaming history? Is that like my sexual history?
I don't know. Is it?
Some games.
Are you Fireflower positive?
What?
It does burn when I pee a little bit.
I mean, he has a fire in his loins. Get it?
I'm sure that's what you meant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, there is that new game that we just talked about on the A side with the penis controller. But let's talk about your gaming history.
Why? I'd just like to point out that game already existed. What we were talking about was that
Oculus
it now has
Rift.
Oculus Rift
yes,
support.
Are we talking about teledildonics here? Because that's a thing.
Yeah, we're talking about teledildonics.
How did I miss that? Wow. Okay.
By not listening to Game Buoy.
That's the trick on having you on, is you got to listen now.
That episode hasn't gone up yet. Except if,
shut up
if
with the, your logic.
If they're listening to
you're
this, it has.
You're on my team. Shut up.
Anyways, my gaming history. I've been playing games for a long time, since I was a kid, probably.
What was your first console?
An Atari 2600.
Wow.
My dad bought it.
Girl, you're kind of old.
My dad was super interested in what that thing was, so he bought it. And he wasn't sure if the kids were going to like it at all. I think he bought it for himself, but he never played it, and then we ended up playing it all the time. I can't remember the names of the games for that thing.
Blip-blop.
Flip-flop,
Foozle Flazzle,
Random Pixels.
Atari 2600 games were super generic. It was like casino, baseball, combat, you know, war.
The one with tanks, I remember, it was probably called Tanks.
Combat.
Oh, that was combat.
That was the packing game, yeah.
Tank.
Oh, gosh. I've been, you know, begging for consoles as they came out when I was a kid, and I'd get a few of them. So I have gaps in my... you know, my gaming history for certain console generations.
You gap gamed a bitch.
So I totally missed out. I never had a Super Nintendo or Genesis. I missed that generation in, like, playing those games now.
You know, the funny thing is that's favorites. Actually really similar to my experience. I got SNES a little bit later because I was actually a Sega Genesis kid. I'm a little bit ashamed to say because I love the Super Nintendo so much, but I was actually a few years late to that and a few years late to the N64, so.
I should just buy myself a Super Nintendo because, you know, I'm an adult and I can buy things, but I never have.
Is this the tank game that you were playing?
That is the one.
So he was actually talking about Battlezone.
Oh, okay.
I knew as soon as I said
there
that.
There was another tank game from the top down, I believe. For the 2600 that I also played.
That's got to be combat.
That was
that's
the one I was thinking
probably
of.
Combat. So, okay, excellent. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt, but this, you know, details.
I also missed out on a lot of the classic arcade games since where I lived and the crowd I hung around with was never arcade people. We never had a lot of arcades around my area. But I've been catching myself back up on those games because I built myself a MAME cabinet.
So nice.
And I got all the classic arcade games just so I could sort of edumacate myself on them.
Sounds like a great way to play Miss Nude World 96.
It's an amazing way to play Miss Nude World 96.
It's the best way to play Miss Nude World 96.
Anytime I have a party at my house, it all devolves into people playing games on that cabinet, so it's great.
Excellent. So how do we know each other? How do you know Game Buoy?
I know Spike for reasons and things.
And stuff.
And stuff. And then I met you two. Yeah. You two fools through Spike.
Did you just call them fools?
Yep.
Rude.
But like in the loving Mr. T sort of way. I pity the fool.
That's fair.
Hey, fool.
I don't think he was being loving when he called people fools.
Oh.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about your favorite games and maybe a left of center classic or two that maybe our listeners won't be familiar with.
That was my
with.
Job to ask him.
You're not doing super good.
So Tim, what is your favorite game and or a left of center game that you like or a strange title or two?
I don't know. I have a really tough time choosing my favorite game or favorite games. Just my brain just doesn't work that way.
Oh, you're one of those.
I'm one of those.
Oh, just say Tomb Raider.
I can't. Well, that would be like the most awkward plug ever, and it's not my favorite game. It's
scandalous.
It's an awesome game, and you should all buy it. Like, buy it twice and buy.
I actually did buy it twice. I bought it on Xbox.
Thanks to that Steam sale,
and on Steam.
Excellent, excellent. But if you want, like, one of the things I really love about games is the music in them, and so I can sort of give you some of the games I love with great music.
Delightful.
And since this is
how topical,
since
this
is a music themed episode.
Are you just going to talk about Chrono Cross for 20 minutes?
I will talk about Chrono Trigger and Chrono Cross for as long as you want because I love anything by Yasunori Mitsuda. I love some of the classic Mario, like Koji Kondo music from Mario. Those songs, like, all stick in my head.
I mean, they're iconic.
They're totally iconic.
Put it closer to your mouth.
Whoa. Right. Save it for off the air, gentlemen.
I love, music from Final Fantasy. I'd say Final Fantasy VIII is my favorite Final Fantasy soundtrack. It was incredibly solid. Mm.
Okay, you fixed that when you said soundtrack, because I was about ready to judge you for a minute there.
No, I also love Final Fantasy VIII, the game. It
no!
is one of my favorites.
Wrong choice. It's one of the worst. I can't
I don't care
stand
that this is your
eight.
Studio. Get out of here.
No. You get out.
Well, maybe that'll count as my offbeat game that I really
that's,
like.
That's totally, yeah.
I have waited 33 episodes for Slagkick to get a good burn-in on someone, and it finally happened.
How was a burn?
33 and a half.
For him.
I guess more recently, some of the games that really stood out for soundtracks have been things like Shadow of the Colossus. I really loved the music in the Assassin's Creed games. I love the quirky modern music in Persona.
Yes, Persona 4, oh my god.
Yeah, both 3 and 4 had some great selections.
And do you want to give any plugs or shout-outs to anything?
So I'm not a podcaster. I'm not really involved in the podcast community, but I am a game developer, and we do make games, and we do need people to buy them. So please go buy Tomb Raider if you haven't already. Or if you have, buy a second
copy.
Yeah.
Buy it for a friend.
And don't copy that floppy.
Don't copy that floppy.
And why don't you tell us a little bit about Orange Lounge Radio, the place where every gamer has a voice.
Maybe Vogue Network. You want to talk about gamification?
VogueNetwork.com.
Kickstarter's right? Bad $35,000 joke. I don't know. You guys always say it, so.
All right. I couldn't possibly be happier with the way our guests lined up for us this week. I know I've said that like 8 times, but it really bears repeating. I really appreciate you both taking time out of your busy schedules on the weekend. Rob, I know you're recording another show in literally a handful of hours.
It happens.
We really appreciate your participation. So, with that having been said, I think it's time to get a little bit of a start on our discussion and take a look at the early steps on the timeline of rhythm gaming. Slagkick, if you would like to get us started off with the events of 1987.
Well, I mean, I think the thing that those of us who were around back then which I think would probably be most of our listeners too, but you know, we might have some youngs out there. Back in 87 is when Dance Aerobics came out for the NES and used the power pad. And like, you know, at the time I was just like, oh, aerobics, lol. But I mean, I didn't really think about it until, like, you know, I was an adult and having played rhythm games in the context of really being kind of the first rhythm game that I can think of in terms of dancing. So, I mean, and this was like way before DDR was even a thing.
Yeah, I actually, you know, I distinctly remember the power pad, of course, but I'm specifically looking at Rob because it looks like he has something to say.
Well,
about
I played this game actually when I was younger. I borrowed the power pad from a friend of mine. Like, you know how like you would trade like things. So I don't know what I gave him of mine. Probably some
You're
game
Rob.
You wanted.
I have this exact same story, so this is hilarious to me.
Awesome. This is why we're sisters. So
sister.
Never knew how much I missed her.
So I play Dance Aerobics. I thought it would, like, I thought, you know, seeing the clips of Nintendo Power and so forth, like, you kind of go, this looks like a stupid game. This looks like a mom game. Like, you even kind of think that at a young age. Like, this looks like a mom game. But I remember playing it because I borrowed the power pad to play, you know, World Class Track Meet.
Yes.
Right, there was only, like, 5 power pad games, right? There was there was the other Bandai game. I know Short Order Explode came later, and there's one other that's escaping my mind, but there's, you know, one other power pad game, and then there's this. So I actually played this. I rented it and played it, and I remember it was about like getting coins. Like, coins was like a big thing in this game, and it's about like where you step. So yeah, this is probably the first music game in many ways that I played, but no licensed songs, none of those frills.
Oh, I was hoping that you were dancing to, like, popcorn.
I don't remember, maybe. I mean, putting classic songs in games is a great way to not have to pay for things. Like, look at Boom Boom Rocket. Like,
right.
So.
Well, you know, I have literally the exact same story. Probably the only difference is that when I was playing World Class Track Meet, I can never really get the name of that game right because I want to talk about Konami's Track and Field when I talk about it. I would always just like hop off of the mat for long jump so that I would be doing like super long jump.
Girl, we all did that. We all did that. And it became the metagame, like jumping off the pad. And when can I put my foot right back down before
jumping
I get DQ'd?
Back on. Exactly.
That became the new game.
I never knew. I'm so happy we're having this discussion.
There's probably listeners out there going, me too, and doing, like, flappy hands right now.
Well, it's worth mentioning, like, we literally have, like, 2 people that listen to this show. So
and they're in this room.
And we're here in studio.
It's Captain Spike and First Mate Slackick.
It's like us and the Koopa Club kids listen to us sometimes.
Aww.
But at least maybe those guys are like, I did that too.
Awesome.
I'm going to do this a little bit different than normal, and I'm going to say, Tim, do you want to take a look at these show notes? Take a look at what happened in 1992 and maybe talk about that game a little bit.
Oh my god, Mario Paint.
I thought you'd like that one.
Mario Paint is awesome, and I missed out on it because I didn't have an SNES.
I just put you in the line of fire.
You totally
did.
Sorry. Thanks for rubbing a little salt in that wound.
But clearly you know the game.
And it has a lasting impact.
It does. And I've actually downloaded some utilities for the PC to make my own Mario Paint.
That's the
music.
Cool thing is that Mario Paint composer, there's a huge community out there. I don't know if it's huge, but you know, for something like this. And I mean, you go on YouTube, look up like Mario Paint Funky Town, and
I was just gonna say, I was literally at a party a week or two ago where someone pulled out their phone and played a Mario Paint Funky Town cover
for the second year in a row.
I want invites to these parties. That sounds rad.
You probably were invited.
Oh shit.
For anyone interested, that was me. Sorry.
I knew, but I didn't know if you wanted to be outed as Funky Town.
I was trying to be so annoying that I would get kicked out of a game that I was not having fun playing, so. And it totally worked. They killed me off. We were playing Werewolf.
For Funky Town.
Yeah.
And you probably were invited. This was Jason.
Yes, I was invited, and it conflicted with something else I had that day here locally, sadly.
So why don't we... do you personally have any Mario Paint music memories? That's a fun thing to say.
Yeah. Well, most of my memories have just been listening to awesome songs remixed with Mario Paint on YouTube.
Well, I guess in a way we just talked about an awesome Mario Paint music memory of yours.
Yes, exactly.
You know, the thing that's interesting to me, and I'm sorry, it looks like Rob was about to say something.
Well, he's got the mic next.
I always have something to say, so just
is that, you know,
good radio.
We're talking about rhythm games, but this is Mario Paint, and I mean, there was so much more to Mario Paint, but for some reason,
nobody's
going to
talk about Fly Swatter in 2013.
I'm just saying that it's interesting that out of Mario Paint, it's the music composing that people are still talking about and still active with. And
I'm sorry, excuse you, because I was about to say that there's two things people remember from Mario Paint, and it's not the fucking painting. It's the music and the fly swatter game, you ass. Because what else used the goddamn mouse on Super Nintendo? I think there was one other game that I remember. It was some medieval theme puzzle game, if I remember right.
I was just
going
to say, I think it's like King Arthur's Castle. It is,
yeah. There's like one other game that used the mouse, right? And then there's fly swatter. So excuse me, you, because fly swatter was awesome, even though that has nothing to do with music game.
I have to mention that there is one Mario Paint song on YouTube in particular that I find wonderful. It's like a 9.5 minute retrospective of video game music and the evolution of it, and it was all done in Mario Paint. And I think it's just, if you just search for evolution of video games Mario Paint, it will come up by a guy named Adolfo Baez. It's fantastic. If we had 9.5 minutes to listen to a song, I'd recommend doing that, but that would make for not great radio.
So I got a little weepy the first time I heard that.
Before, when this game was out, we didn't have the internets. So, like, did you guys ever get the magazine that would actually show you how to put in, like, Mario in the thing, and you would actually input it in for the magazine?
Yeah, I had the Nintendo Power Strategy Guide or whatever.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah. I want to point out that the game we were just talking about was King Arthur's World. But kind of upsettingly, is that a word? I don't care. There's like 40 SNES games that supported the SNES mouse that I just pulled up on Wikipedia.
Really?
Stuff like Acme Animation Factory, Dungeons and Dragons Eye of the Beholder.
Wow.
Arkanoid. And I'm thinking about it like...
Get out.
Well, I'm thinking about it like, actually, no, these games did all have the little icon on the box.
Oh,
like,
God. I really missed that. But I never owned the mouse. My best friend did in high school.
The Lord of the Rings Volume 1 game, that really, really awful one that they always talked about Nintendo Power like it was good, but it was actually awful.
Oh.
Huh.
Yeah, Lemmings 2.
Wow. I learned something on today's Game Boy.
There's one that you're really excited about, Tim.
I saw that there's a Mario Super Picross game. It was Japan only. That's probably why I never saw it. I love Picross.
So you have to stage whisper if you're going to whisper, because we're on radio.
I don't know what that means. I've been on radio a total of two times.
You have to remember the girl who was in movies like Matilda and Miracle on 34th Street, the remix?
So
Mara Wilson, I think. She used to talk like this.
So just talking.
She's actually a really cool blogger
your
now.
Normal volume, but in tone whispering like
oh, this. Yeah. Okay. Like this. Okay, Sansuke.
Believe it.
Okay, we're going way.
We're not talking
way
about Neuralultimate games.
So... Slagkick, I believe that we have one more note in this time period that we really need to hit, and it's not PC Bach for 3DO.
Although the fun little tidbit about PC Bach is that was a Sid Meier game, and Jeff Briggs, later going on to found Firaxis.
It's like you found the one interesting thing about that game, and you were so intent on
because
making it happen.
Because I love Civilization.
Yeah, shut exactly. You gotta show respect to Sid Meier. Not just Civilization, but Colonization, Covert Action, which I will cut you if you don't think that game is good. And Pirates, right?
Well, Pirates, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sid Meier's a legend.
But, of course, what Captain Spike is alluding to is 1996's Simtoons by Maxis, of course. And no, it did not require an always-online connection. It was described as a children's software toy, and it was developed by Toshio Iwai and had music and painting. So, interestingly, kind of, I wouldn't say a cousin to Mario Paint.
Well, the real interesting thing is that this was originally developed
as a Super Famicom game. Yeah.
Yes.
Called Sound Fantasy, and Nintendo canceled it. So, they just ended up making it Simtoons on the PC. And, you know, the thing that's interesting is that a lot of these early rhythm games, as we're calling them, were more like creation tools. I know we weren't really going to talk about PC Bach, but it like could generate concertos based on parameters that you set. So a lot of these were involving creating music.
Are you done?
Yes.
So
PC Bach was also a 3DO game.
You know, I'm shading you, of course, for going on and on and on, but you actually did exactly what I needed you to do there. And that was sort of cap off the discussion on the origins of rhythm gaming. Because, you know, as we discussed, that was a 1996 title. And there was another really popular 1996 title that a lot of people look at as sort of the real birth of the rhythm genre as we know it today.
Parappa.
And because you did that, I want someone who isn't you to talk about Parappa. Any takers?
I will. I love Parappa the Rappa.
I gotta believe.
Who doesn't? I mean, that game is so adorable. And the first time I played that game was actually the demo, because, you know, we used to get the magazines that had the little PlayStation discs in them, so you could play that first stage of Parappa the Rappa. I must have played that like 47 times. Like, it was so...
Chop Chop Master Onion?
Oh, yeah. It was so much fun. And, you know, I was totally a band nerd growing up, which is weird.
Me too.
I didn't take music past high school just because college was so different and so forth, and, you know, I was drunk and everything. But, you know, it's just... I loved it. It was like my two of my favorite things, music and gaming, kind of like coming together. Even though I may not like a lot of rap per se, I mean, Parappa the Rappa was just so different.
Check,
you know?
And turn the signal to the right.
Yes, who doesn't love Moesha or whatever her name was?
I forgot to close the door.
So,
you know, it's funny that you approach it from that angle, because my history with this game again was very similar. I started off with the demo. I typically did not listen to rap at that point in my life, but for whatever reason...
Girl, everyone was listening
to
at least a little bit of Tupac.
I wasn't. I could not put this thing down, and I was all about it. A couple of years later, of course, Jammer Lammy came out.
Jammer Lammy.
I preferred that game, actually.
Me too. I do, too. No,
well,
no,
I love
no
you,
qualms about it.
It had both. You unlocked the Parappa the Rappa doing the Jammer Lammy songs later, and I think that's what I like best about it.
Can I help you? my claim to fame on Jammer Lammy, of course, is that, and maybe it's possible that someone listening to this episode will actually have been there the night I'm about to talk about, when that game finally came out, I rented it at my local Blockbuster, and I ended up playing that entire game, Jammer Lammy, start to finish, over and over, until the sun came up, throughout the entire night in single player.
And then you were like, no, cutting corners.
Well, yeah, actually, you may know Amanda, who will almost certainly be on this show someday, so I feel dropping her name. To this day, if you ever just walk up to her and go, no, cutting corners, she will immediately respond with, she's on the border.
No!
So,
the thing about both of these games is that they both had amazing soundtracks. I mean, of course, they had the distinctive art style from Rodney Greenblatt.
I couldn't have done that guy's name. Well played.
I love Parappa and Jammer Lammy.
I was just going to say that I think Princess Irene and I have a very similar story to you, because this game would have come out
sisters.
Like, well, actually, it came out in 96. We probably didn't get around to it until a little later, because I think maybe 96 is a Japanese release. Maybe I don't think it came here until a little later.
That's probably true.
So I honestly probably didn't really get around to owning this game until like 99 or 2000. Oh no, Jammer Lammy was 99. Never mind. That seems a lot closer, because that would have been right around the time I moved out of college, and I was in my own apartment for the first time. And I think one of the first things we did in my own apartment, Princess Irene came over, and we played the two-player, like Jammy and Rammy, right?
Oh, yeah.
Until, like, 4 in the morning.
Yes!
Let's fist bump that. Yes!
Yes. Excellent.
And I just like to point out that those were developed by Na-na-na-na-na-na-na Onsha.
Who needs to do more?
Yeah, they really do.
Yeah.
Parappa 2 was not enough.
Yeah, Parappa 2 was okay, but, I mean, just it did not compare.
Tim, do you have any experience with Parappa the Rapper or Jammer Lammy?
I did play Parappa the Rapper. I played the demo to death, because, like Rob, I got it on a demo disc for something. But I do have to apologize. I never played Jammer Lammy.
But, I mean, you have now, right?
No.
PS1 classics, like $5. You got to do it.
He literally has it on his PS3 already, because I purchased it there.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. Worst emergency replacement guest ever. Sorry.
No, you're really, truly not.
I do have to point out one little factoid that some people might not know about Jammer Lammy, is that the stage with Teriyaki Yoko, which in the Western version takes place on like a tropical island, in
if
the
you
Japanese
in hell,
version,
you go fuck.
Yeah, it takes place in hell because Lammy actually dies. Lammy.
Spoilers.
I
no, I remember this. Yeah.
Yeah, and
on the plane, right?
I think it was on the plane.
Yeah, because there's the plane stage is the headbanging stage, and it crashes, and you go to hell. Yeah.
I thought milk was pink.
This is going to be SV, like, autopilot on, autopilot off. Little bit of this, little bit of that.
I was a hero, but
now, do you like munchies?
We're done. We're done. Let's wrap it
up. We didn't even get to do the baby stage.
Mama, 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 mama.
Give me some milk. Give me some food.
I need a potty. Yes, I'll be naughty.
What the hell is going on right now?
I'm Jammer Miami. It's what's going on. And I mean, I think that's a testament to, this was what, like almost 15 years later that we are still in love with this game.
Can we do like a custom announcer pack for Dota 2 where we just do quotes from Parappa Rappa and Unjammer?
Is that a thing? Because I would.
I think so.
Excellent. Well, let's move this one forward. I'm a little worried that no one here is going to have any compelling stories about this game. But these next two games, in fact, are two of my very favorite, and so we're not skipping them. Sorry. Bust a Groove. Any takers?
Oh, God. Bust a Groove. Well, two. I didn't get into it until two. I actually never owned one. So to be fair, you know, and it wasn't until two. And I never knew about the Japanese releases having completely different soundtracks. Like, you know, I didn't know that because the internet wasn't totally, you know, realized at that point yet until later when I got into DDR and made my friends there. But, oh, God, that we again, just getting everybody. It was a lot of the people that did Rocky Horror. I did Rocky Horror Picture Show with
at the
time.
I'm not surprised to hear that.
Would get around, like, we'd have a rehearsal and then we'd have a party where we just play Bust a Groove 2. And that really kind of was the game that enabled the future music games. I mean, I know we kind of credit Parappa as being the first, but I don't know. There was just something different about the way that Bust a Groove 2 kind of worked, and especially maybe the competitive edge and the fact that, you know, you had your attack dances and things like that, that kind of just made it like an even better party game in that regard.
For some reason, I always, like, until I was doing research for this episode, I always thought of that as a Square game, but that was an NX game. I always had that crossed in my head for some reason.
And the Capoeira song from 2 is, like, one of my favorites.
It's so good.
Yes.
The thing, and I'm going to tie this into what you were just saying, in fact, to me, the thing that really got me about Bust a Groove, and I played the first one. I was a huge fan. This came out when I was at the prime of my, like, Japanophilia. Like, I was downloading these songs off of Napster and making people in my Japanese class, like, mix CDs of
Audio Galaxy.
You got, like, a tramp stamp tattoo of Cloud.
Oh, man. I did. I did. No, I truly didn't. But this game in particular, really, is where I would say the Japanese sort of idea. A lot of people talk about how their rhythm games are made with a different sensibility. There's a lot more focus on really tight timing windows and, like, really being on beat and very little room for failure or, you know, sort of. And just to skip ahead just a little bit, people play, for example, Guitar Hero now and talk about, oh, the timing windows are so loosey-goosey compared to something like Guitar Freaks.
Yeah.
To me,
so I was just thinking of
Bust a Groove was really the first game where that timing window element really came strongly into play, especially compared to something like Parappa, where you could get, you know, you rapping cool by basically just spamming triangle.
You know what else was cool about Bust a Groove is that you had choice. Like, you, because sometimes you wouldn't necessarily have to put in, you had like two, I think you never got three, but I think like you had two options.
Like up triangle or up left circle.
Yes, and because scoring was such an important element in that game, actually knowing which one to pick could to inflate your score could be the difference between win and lose.
Yeah, or playing it safe and, oh, I know my opponent isn't going to be able to do the tricky one, I'll do the easy one.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely. That was, in a lot of ways, a real game changer, and some of these things have really not, some of these gameplay elements have really not made a return in this space, for reasons that I certainly don't understand.
Well, it sucks they never really did. I mean, technically there was Dance Summit, but that's when they tried to introduce a peripheral into that because it was the height of all that craze. You know, it really sucks that they never did another one, but of course this was an Enix game, you know, they got bought, and so this is just one of the things that kind of fell to the side. Because, let's be real, Square wanted Dragon Quest.
Yeah, well,
yeah,
hard to fault them that.
Yeah, I know.
Anyway, moving forward, I'm going to talk about one of my very favorite games here. I'm not really going to open up the floor for takers on this one. I want to talk about a game that released in 1999 for the PS1, also developed by Nana Onsha. I'm talking, of course, about Vib Ribbon. You might be familiar with Vib Ribbon for its striking... gosh darn it, I forgot the word I was just going to use. Vector! vector graphics. It generated...
Oh, like I had put right here on the show notes.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Oh, son of a gun. So you could just use any CD you wanted to procedurally generate... Is that the right word for that?
Yes.
Yay, Mr. Programmer helped me so much.
Glad to be here.
Excellent. It would procedurally generate stages based on the CDs that you would put into the game. And it would always be a challenge at parties. People would come over and play this really quirky, super stripped-down, bizarre, sparse little game. And people would just bring CDs over my house to parties to see, oh, let's play the people would call it like the Bouncing Rabbit game. Because, you know, Japanese games, ain't no one trying to think about the names of the games.
I want to put my Glassjaw CD in.
Well, no, people, funny enough, would the one that would always get played at parties, especially once people started drinking, would be NoFX's The Decline.
Oh, my
God.
It'd
be like, who can play this one stage for 20 minutes and get through it?
We used to play burned CDs of DDR music because we're such nerds.
That's awesome.
But, yeah, it was fun.
We would do, like, burned, like, Gundam Wing soundtracks. So I'm there with you.
It's like, just wild beat communication.
Stop.
I do have to point out, I have played VibRibbon, and VibRibbon is a really cool game, and I just got to, you know, mention the fact that it did have its own music, and it has a really bizarre soundtrack, and I totally recommend listening to it because
jumping
it's...
Jumping by the river, la ba la ba la ba ba da beat da beat da beat.
It is so bizarre, but it's worth it. It's really creative music.
Take long time, hurry up.
I love that song.
It is. It's kind of like a Katamari-ish soundtrack in a way. I think is a good way to compare it.
Absolutely,
like a minimalistic Katamari.
Let's see who hasn't had a game to go in a while because this is going to be a big one. Tim,
okay. Wait, were you going to name Mojo Ribbon? Because I actually did play that.
Okay, yeah. Let's sidetrack real quick and talk about the spiritual sequel, Mojo Ribbon, released in 2003 for PlayStation 2.
It relied a little heavier on the Japanese. I didn't like it as much. That's all I wanted to say. I didn't like it as much.
It's funny.
What about Vib Ripple?
The reason I haven't played Mojo Ribbon is specifically because the Japanese text knowledge required in 2003. I was like, nope.
Yeah, I had a friend around that time who could do enough Japanese to get through it, and you know, imported all the stuff from Japan, and we all went to his house and kind of watched him play it. But it wasn't really clicking for me. Like, what the hell was going on?
Wasn't it something crazy like calligraphy and text files
Yes.
or something?
Yeah. Oh yeah. It seemed like writing was like a big thing in it. So
That's bizarre. Does anyone want to talk about Vib Ripple, which I have not played?
I've never played it, but it allowed you to import photographs, so I'm sure that it was colloquially known as Vib Nipple.
Well,
get out.
See, you're like, get out. I'm like, for the first time, I respect you.
Because of nipples.
You know me. I'm hard to please. Moving forward, Tim, I think you would probably really like to talk about this next one.
I would love to because it was one of my favorite games on the Dreamcast, and that, of course, is Space Channel 5.
Space Channel 5.
It was such a quirky game, and it was such a fun thing to play, or even just to watch.
Pudding!
Yes, pudding. I spent pretty much an entire summer playing Space Channel 5 every day. This is back in high school, and my mom would always watch and like, what the hell is this? And then Space Michael would come out. She's like, is that Michael Jackson? And like, yes, it is.
My son is a homosexual.
She didn't know it before. She's certainly not.
And for those of you, of course, who are listening to this and are worried that we've only covered a handful of years here, I just want to point out that the quirky rhythm game section, because of the audience like and who we have here in studio today, this is going to be the section that we take the longest on. So that having been said, let's get back to Space Shuttle 5.
Deal with it, period.
So who else had a crush on Jaguar? This sucks.
Maybe a little. Maybe a little.
Like, I literally wanted to cosplay and go to, you know, Fenimicon and dress up as Jaguar. Amanda and Seawolf Jason had offered to be backup dancers if I did this. Just so that I could do the Jaguar thing.
That's amazing, though.
Honestly, the rewards I got out of Space Channel 5 were like watching an episode of RuPaul's Drag Race, because it's like, these bitches be fierce, and here's Pudding throwing shade at people. You know, that was the rewards from Space Channel 5. And then random-ass Michael Jackson cameo, which was always hilarious.
There should have been like a Space Channel 5 show.
Well, you know, she appeared, Ooh La La appeared at the 1999 MTV
Video
VMAs.
Yeah.
That was like a big deal at the time.
Oh, yeah.
Really, you know, Sega was pushing real hard for her to be a big name. You know, there was, of course, the lawsuit and controversy from Lady Miss Keir from D-Light.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, Sega had originally approached Lady Miss Keir to be the sort of face of Space Channel 5. And when she turned down the... It was less than $100,000. This information is publicly available through court records. I want to say that it was like $50,000, but that's off the top of my head. And she basically was like, that is not enough money. So they changed the character enough that in the eyes of the law, it was changed enough not to be infringing on her copyrights.
I don't mean to shade Lady Miss Keir because, you know, obviously she's great and a lot of people love her. But it seems so funny to me that, like, she couldn't do the game. And, you know, so they had to kind of change it to get, you know, her image in there. Yet they have Michael Jackson in the game, like the king of pop is in the game. No problem.
Yeah. Well,
but there's an issue with, you lady know, Miss the groove King. Is in the heart, lady.
Well, and this Sorry, is in 1999.
Funny
like,
to me.
Girl, your time has come and gone. Take what you can get.
Like, I realize she's big in the club scene and all that stuff, and a lot of people really like her, but it's just funny to me that, like, Michael Jackson, no problem.
Well, and, you know, it's, you know, a little bit off topic, but Michael Jackson has strong ties to Sega throughout history
as
well.
I was just thinking about Sonic the Hedgehog 3.
Mm-hmm.
To say nothing of the Michael Jackson games they made.
Sure.
Yeah.
So, it's really funny. I'd never thought about that in the context of we couldn't get Lady Miss Keir, but we got Michael Jackson.
No, it's like, I get, well, Lady Miss Keir wouldn't do the game. Who's number two on the list? Oh, Michael Jackson. Let's give him a call. Like,
gosh, suddenly I need to go install Moonwalker on my MIME cabinet as soon as I get home.
How do you not have that already?
I don't know. I don't know how I, that was an oversight.
I love when you get Bubbles the monkey and turn into Mecha Michael. It's a real thing that happens. To get back on track, has anyone here ever played the Game Boy Advance port of Space Channel 5?
Honestly, no.
Ooh La La's Funky Dance or something?
No. I did not know that existed.
It was awful.
It was by THQ.
Oh,
may they rest in peace.
Dude, that was a weird partnership. That and Crazy Taxi for GBA. I want to say that there was also a Jet Set Radio that they did.
I feel like there was too much that was tried to get ported to the GBA that just was like, no, that shouldn't happen.
Talk into your mic.
That shouldn't happen.
Anyways, but that's
Rob
about
is
rhythm
here
games.
Like being super classy. He's making hand motions. I'm like, we are a pirate show. Like, we are not professionals.
You break rules.
I wasn't talking about rhythm games anyways, whatever.
We break rules so we can recreate rules. It's a thing.
Yeah, I think that Space Channel 5 and Space Channel 5 Part 2 are both amazing.
Well, I was just going to get to Space Channel 5 Part 2, and I don't want to talk too much more about this because obviously we still have a long way to go. Sorry, listeners. But Space Channel 5 Part 2, super widely available even in the current age because of Steam. It was on sale just the other day for something like $1.99.
Oh, I bought the hell out of that.
Does anyone want to talk about Space Channel 5 Part 2 for just a moment before we move on?
From what I remember of Space Channel 5 Part 2, it was very similar to Space Channel 5 Part 1. However, they experimented with different styles of music and
yes,
slightly different types of puzzles. They had the battles with the guitars.
With pudding.
Yeah, that was my favorite part, too.
Yeah, with that first one where you're out by the fountain
where it's spinning around.
Yes.
I remember that stage, too. It was an epic stage.
I love there's the plant with the tentacles, and Ooh La La's
yes.
like, not there.
Yes.
And I loved how they experimented with different types of music. Like that plant level was it turned into a waltz at some point.
Yes, yes. Oh, man, that game also did a lot more with sound effects so that as in that song particularly, the crowd behind Ooh La La is dancing. They're also tap dancing or stomping or something to the beat of the song. I really think Space Channel 5 Part 2 is a lot better than Space Channel 5.
Although no discussion of Space Channel 5 can be had without talking about Mexican Flyer, which is just so amazing that Sega had to buy it.
Yeah, Sega actually owns that song now. It's not just licensed.
Wow.
All right, moving forward. We have Samba de Amigo.
Aww.
Dun, 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 dun.
That was a fun, very different kind of music game, you know? And I remember the weird mat.
With the weird Sonic location detector.
Yeah, I still don't think I understand how that thing worked, but whatever, it did.
It uses some kind of super high-frequency sound device, like that echolocation. I swear to God, this is a real
cool
thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's neat.
I wonder if it interacts with pacemakers or anything.
There was an arcade version, if I remember right, too.
Yes, there was. Mm-hmm. There was also, in 2008, Gearbox made a Wii port.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's on your list later, so I'm sorry if I'm jumping ahead, but wasn't there that spin-off game with the tambourine that was in the arcades? There was a tambourine game that was so funny.
And it's not on our list because, like, even for us, that
it is a little niche. They never made a home version of it, but I played that once. There was a legendary arcade in the L.A. area. Rowland Heights is where it was located. It was called Arcade Infinity.
I have heard of that. Continue.
It's gone now, but it was almost nothing but music-based games. And one time they had the Rhythm to Tambourine or whatever that game was called. I'm sure you're looking it up now. The tambourine game. And it was a lot of fun. But it's like you have to do – you just have to basically swing your body. You're like Stevie Nicks up there with your tambourine.
Oh, girl.
It's fun. It's a fun game.
Yeah, that sounds really quite incredible.
I think one of the things that's really neat about Samba de Amigo is just that it's got such an interesting flavor to it.
With regard to the Latin flavor or
– Yeah, yeah.
Wasn't Samba de Amigo one of the first games with DLC?
Yes.
If you remember? Yeah,
yes, on the Dreamcast.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I had Dreamcast DLC. And you could even get one or two songs free, if I remember right. So I always kind of associate Samba de Amigo with like one of the first DLC games I remember.
And it wasn't, I don't think it was necessarily the first plastic instruments game, because, I mean, you had like Guitar Freaks and stuff, I think, a couple years before which we'll get to in a little bit.
We're going a little side.
Sega getting in on that.
It was such a notable one, because it's maracas.
And the thing that, for me, that was really special about that, and, you know, I mean, this is going to make me sound a little bit awful, but I remember one of the downloadable songs for that was Open Your Heart, the theme to Sonic Adventure. It's like this really bad, like, butt metal. I effing loved that song, and as soon as I got that game home, like, the first thing I did, Samba de Amigo, was open it up and see, like, oh my God, can I download Open Your Heart? I need butt metal in my life right now.
You know, I'm really surprised they haven't tried to re-release Samba de Amigo on, like, Xbox with Kinect or something. Because all you'd need to see is where the hands are, right?
And then you could use real maracas if you wanted.
Yeah, it could just have an object, but I don't know.
Like dildos.
I'm kind of surprised we never really saw that come back.
Yeah, well, you know, there was the 2008 Wii port. And
yeah,
the Wiimotes did have clip-on maracas so that they could be
rattly.
That's right.
It was kind of super awkward.
Yeah,
And that also had DLC. That had paid DLC of actual like licensed music. Are You Gonna Be My Girl by Jet? I Want Candy by Bow Wow Wow.
Didn't the original Dreamcast one have like Take on Me or something? I think it
Well,
did.
Well, the Dreamcast one's DLC was all Sega songs.
Oh, wow. I thought there was licensed stuff in there, too.
Like, Take On Me was in that game, but I think in the U.S. at least, it was just on the disc.
Oh, okay. Then I'm just crossing my wires.
But this was stuff like Afterburner, the theme from Burning Rangers, Dreams, Dreams from Nights into Dreams. That's a really redundant sentence. but yeah, so that's Samba de Amigo. Does anyone else have anything to say about it?
I'm just glad that Samba... Wait, his name... What was his name? Was his name Amigo? I feel bad. I don't remember.
I think it's Amigo.
It's Amigo.
Amigo. That he lives on in, like, games like Sonic All-Stars Racing Danica Patrick Edition.
I was just thinking the same thing. Yeah, he still lives on.
Even if they're not really doing too much with that IP, that they're still showing him a little love.
Yeah, no, definitely. That was I was really big into that Sonic airboarding game, Sonic Riders, specifically because, Amigo and Ooh La La are in this game. And I'm really happy to see that.
They were also both in Sega All-Stars Tennis, which I actually found super fun.
Oh, yeah. Sega Tennis Superstars.
Yes, that's it.
I didn't even realize that they were in that. That's awesome. Does anyone have anything compelling to say about Gitaru Man?
I played it. It was fun. The use of the analog controller to kind of trace, I think, was kind of like the new thing in that game that hadn't really been seen yet. So it was kind of a neat little mechanic.
I remember my high school girlfriend was really into it.
It's a great game. Quirky, huge cult following for this game. It got a PSP port, Gitaru Man Lives, in 2006. And this was, of course, made by INIS, whom we're going to talk about a little bit more later, made some really, really incredible games later in their career. Gitaru Man is mostly notable, though, for its awesome, like, J-rock sounding music.
Was this Puppety Puppety? Or am I thinking of a different game?
I don't know what you're communicating.
I think you're thinking of Beatmania Thane.
Oh, sorry.
Okay, no, that's a thing that happens. Unfortunately, I don't necessarily have a lot to say about Gitaru Man. It was really novel at the time, as Rob says. You had to basically follow a track using the analog stick on your controller and sort of, you know, change the direction of
while
your stick.
While you beat match.
Yeah. While you're beat matching. Strict timing windows. I know a lot of people who had some issues with that game in the harder difficulties. But just a great game. I really highly support it. And obviously, can't say for sure because of the cluster that the PSN PSP shop is these days, but I would recommend looking and seeing if you can download this on your PSP or Vita, because it's a great game. It really deserves to be experienced. And this next one I know Tim is a big fan of, so if you'd like to take this.
Oh, I love it. Taiko no Tatsujin. It's basically, at least if you play it in the arcade, you get a giant taiko drum and some sticks to bang on it. And I spent many hours when I was in Japan playing Taiko no Tatsujin. It had a great lineup of music. There was a whole category of video game music. Of course, it was competitive as well. Two taiko drums next to each other, and you work up quite a sweat playing it.
I'm just going to mention this for people who are listening to this show that are going to be in the San Francisco, Japantown area next week for the Gamer X convention.
To hopefully see Podcast Cross Zone panel.
Hopefully to see the Podcast
Cross
Zone
panel.
Featuring three of us. There is currently a Taiko no Tetsujin arcade machine in Japantown right now.
Oh, nice.
As well as a pop-in machine, get to pop-in a little later.
Sweet. And a game where you have to upend a tea table.
Yeah, they do have the tea table.
Oh, they have the table
game.
Flipping game?
Yes, they do.
We're going to have to get some.
They also
video
have the
that.
Rhythm Heaven arcade game.
Oh, my God.
This is actually a super legit little arcade.
We're going to have to get some video for the Game Buoy.
When the
YouTube
shit
feed.
Did they put an arcade in Japantown?
Like 6 months ago.
What?
It's awesome.
It's like a giant Pikachu.
Why did nobody call me? Where is my invite? It's fine.
Well, this is a thing that'll have to happen next week.
Yeah, but there's going to be like 100 gay guys all around the table trying to play.
Upend their tea tables. Oh, that sounds like a dirty thing.
Whoa.
Tossing those tables.
Taiko no Tetsujin. Anyone else?
It's also got a port for PS2. You got a little tiny drum.
Mm-hmm.
And you own one of these. Is that correct?
Yes, I do.
I played it, too.
That's the only one that we got in the U.S., actually, in North America.
It's the same game, but part of the reason I really loved playing that game was the giant frickin' drum.
Yeah.
So playing on this tiny little thing in front of you just doesn't have the same visceral feeling as banging on that giant drum.
It's like, Taiko-chan!
I thought, wasn't there one on DS? I thought there was one that came out on DS. Maybe it's a Japan-only game.
This has had PSP and DS ports.
Got it.
I don't know if any have come out in the U.S.
I remember DS1, but I also remember the one in the Wii. I know this didn't come out in the U.S., but it had a little inflatable drum that was adorable.
Aww.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, and they've done Nintendo music in these games.
Yeah, I mean,
so.
It's still really popular in Japan. It's just that this was a Namco game.
Yeah,
it was a Namco game.
They
yeah.
had a lot of Namco music in it. Like, I remember the Soul Calibur songs. Uh-huh. A lot of those were in there.
In fact, we're going to cross over with this game in just a couple more entries. So,
yes,
so we should probably...
Yes.
Move forward. So
if anyone is looking for the North American edition, I believe it's called Taiko Drum Master.
Taiko Drum Master.
Yes, yeah. It is. Well done. In 2001, also,
busy
a
year.
Little studio in Cambridge, MA means Massachusetts, right?
Yes.
Excellent. Based studio called Harmonix. You may or may not have heard of them. Released a title called Frequency for the PlayStation
mm-hmm.
2. This game, of course, still has a big cult following, and I cannot help but imagine that someone in this room must have something to say about it.
I mean, I have things to say, but I'll let other people jump in.
You know what's funny? I didn't play it when it first came out. It was one
really?
Of those. Yeah, it was one of those games, like, you know, I kind of had to revisit later because I played, and I'm sure it's coming up on your list. Yeah, it's another one that's coming up on your list later. I kind of, after I played that one, I had to go back and play Frequency because it was so good.
We can talk about Amplitude now.
I actually think we should talk about both of these games together because of the way we've been grouping titles. So I'm wagging my finger at Slykick, who ordered this part of the show notes.
So
no, but I just said that we could talk about it, so I just made the same executive decision.
Well, Amplitude had some really kick-ass, like, licensed music in it, and I remember it even had, like, mm-hmm. kind of some of the video clips in the background. It was just a really well-made game. game.
That's the thing, is that frequency was kind of like underground electronica. Amplitude made it a lot more
No Doubt
marketable.
And at this time, of course, a lot of us were into Beatmania and Beatmania 2DX, and so there was certainly a very similar feel, but yet it was different. And I remember these games had the freestyle mode, which was like totally a different type of thing, and online. In Amplitude.
Yeah.
I remember it was a big deal when they took the servers down like years later. So it was really cool that you could do the online battle.
And I think another thing that was kind of significant about these games is that Sony let them keep the IP, so that that really allowed them to lay the groundwork for their future games.
Yeah, these were published by Sony.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rock Band Blitz was basically this.
Yeah, it really was. I like Rock Band Blitz a lot.
Uh-huh. And then that was the PSP one, there's the PSP one.
That was Rock Band Unplugged.
Thank you. Rock Band Unplugged was the PSP one, and then Blitz is the one that's on arcade, which is basically...
Yeah.
I mean, it's a little different because it's only the two things that you hit, but still.
Very similar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who wants to talk about the Trance Vibrator?
I think you do.
You that definitely
do. That little smile on your face.
Well...
Do you have one up inside you right now?
Girl... In 2001, Tetsuya Mizuguchi, whom, of course, you all might be familiar
who
with.
Who is a god, let's be real. Yeah.
Well, yes, that's this, exactly.
Oh, my God. Do you count things like Luminous and some of that as music games?
That Girl, is actually two up. Entries down.
Okay, all right, never mind. I'll shut up.
I mean, this is another United Games Artists game, same people from Space Channel 5.
You know, and I can't really speak to this being a real thing that happened, but I always felt like Rez was basically like someone said, do you know what would make Panzer Dragoon better? If it was a music game that you could play while you were on drugs. So they made, you know, the Trance Vibrator, which I just talked about. It was a peripheral that would vibrate in time with the beat. There was actually a lot of really choice sound bites from Mizuguchi-san at this time where people would ask him, oh, where are you supposed to put this? And he would sort of slyly grin and say people could put it wherever they had space for it.
Oh, whoa, salacious.
But basically, you know, this was, I mean, we're talking about Rez, and it's like, what really needs to be said about Rez? I doubt we have any listeners who have not played Rez on either the Dreamcast, the PS2, Xbox Live.
Yeah, go get Rez HD if you have it, because like you've got it, because they did the whole Trance Vibrator thing, but in the controllers.
Yes, and you can have up probably to four a little controllers bit... turned on, and they will just vibrate.
And I did that where I put like one on my back, and like leaning against the chair, like they say to do. You do one on your back, and then one on like each leg or something, and I don't remember.
That's awesome. I just put them all on different corners of my bed, and then like the whole bed was vibrating.
Wow, that's kind of kinky.
No, it wasn't a sex thing.
It was like a lady going on a bumpy bike ride.
Maybe it should have
not
been
there.
The thing is, with the Xbox controller, it's a little bit harder to put wherever you got the space, presumably.
Oh, there's plenty
I know some people,
there's plenty of space in your ego.
Thanks,
girl. Is that what we call it these days? Rez is a classic. Unfortunately, I have a lot of really great anecdotes here, so I think it's we're just going to have to move on. If you have not played Rez, play Rez. We're not going to talk about Child of Eden because it's a disappointment and needs to go home.
I was just
downvoted. Why don't you guys tell me why I need to give it a second chance?
Here's Child of Eden's biggest problem is it's trying to make magic happen twice. And it just wasn't going to happen. And the thing about Child of Eden, and probably what made them want to revisit it in the first place, was the Kinect integration. But Kinect isn't as good in execution as it is on paper, is the Kinect's biggest problem, really. So I think that's why this game feels like a disappointment, because it was something that was designed for Kinect, and Kinect isn't really what we kind of thought it would be. It's still a fun experience on the controller, but not $50 fun. You know?
I had a really good time with that game. I played it with the Kinect integration. And yeah, it wasn't perfect, but it wasn't a game that required precision.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, it was the first time I used Kinect in a way that, I hate to say it, connected with me.
Right.
Bless
him for doing something different with the freaking Kinect that wasn't a freaking dance game or something, you know, like every other Kinect game, right?
Yeah, and the fact that I was like, my body was controlling.
Your body was ready.
It was the first time that, like, Kinect made me feel a part of the game.
Yeah.
And it was kind of a real weird all body experience.
So you actually had an immersion thing happening.
Exactly.
While you're playing.
Immersion is the right word for that.
I wouldn't write off the game the way that you were willing to do. I would at least give it a slow clap.
It wasn't $50.
I own a copy, so I'll go back to it. I'll give it a second chance because of you right now.
All right.
It was a short. Just get out a trance vibrator. Maybe that's what was missing.
I wouldn't blame you if you just wanted to play Res HD again, to be honest.
Fine. I mean,
that might just be what I do.
It's a short game. I played all the way through it. After I was done, I had a really great time, but I didn't feel the need to play it again. I played multiple times.
Well, and maybe that's why I am so willing to dump it, because I did play the whole thing. It took like 35 minutes. Res HD, like, just even Res HD, not even talking about, you know, the PS2 port or the Dreamcast release original, I've probably put hundreds of hours into all this now. So
doesn't that go a long way, though, about saying, like, how important...
How much you like vibrators?
Well, how much really has to be in a game now to satisfy us at that $60, which is, you know, why they keep saying games are more expensive to develop and make and so forth, and why all these costs keep going up, because we demand more now than
absolutely.
We did in the past. So
I will say, of course, we here on Game Buoy are huge proponents of a variable pricing structure. I do think that Child of Eden is a prime game that... for a $30 or $40 price point, probably would have been more palatable.
Well, and at a $20 price point, it would have been like a Katamari Damacy.
Yeah.
Which was originally
exactly.
$20. Yeah.
Perfect. That is the perfect example for me. That's the go-to example, that and Anarchy Reigns, of a game being palatable at a lower price point that would not have flown at a $60 price point.
Or just insert Steam game here.
Yeah, right? You know, EA calls it devaluing IP, but it's getting people to play games that wouldn't have played games otherwise.
Well, it's that whole not to go on a total tangent, it's that whole economic thing I was talking to you guys about last night, about that extra thing we were selling at the show. And I said, you know, if we had tried to sell that for $5, not nearly as many people would have bought it, and we would have ultimately ended up having a loss. But by
they were trans vibrators.
By selling it for $3, we almost sold out of them. You really have to kind of find and made a mm-hmm. profit. But if we sold them more expensively, we probably wouldn't have sold hardly any and made no profit, taking a loss. So it
makes a lot of sense to use something like that on a new IP. Like when they released Katamari, that was new. No one knew mm-hmm. knew what that was, and it was a big risk.
It was a huge gamble.
Yeah, and so $20, you develop it cheaply.
You know,
not a big loss if it flops.
It's safe to say it was a gamble that paid off. I just want to clarify that is now a well-known IP. I don't know I certainly wouldn't call it a world-class IP, but these games do, you know, decent numbers every time.
And to kind of hint at what's going to come later, I kind of wonder with all of the Guitar Heroes and stuff that came out, if those were offered at lower price points, that it would have been a little more palatable, but we'll get to that later.
You know, there was another Namco game that came out around the same time, and it was a music game, and it was valued at $20, and I don't remember what it was, but it had some crossover with some of the artists from DDR. I remember that's why I had played it. And that series, unfortunately, didn't take off the way Katamari did, but it literally came out like the same week. I wish I could remember what it is. I'll have to look it up.
Please do, because in the meantime, I feel the need to talk about Donkey Konga.
Clap, clap.
Yes. You know, we talked a little bit while we were talking about Taiko no Tetsujin that there was sort of a sister series over at Namco.
Sister, sister.
We've already made that reference once today.
You can never make too many sister-sister references.
That is factually incorrect.
Never knew how much I missed you.
So Donkey Konga, of course, takes the basic formula of Taiko no Tetsujin and mixes it up by, you know, obviously pairing with Nintendo for the Donkey Kong IP and gives you, you know, a Konga, like bongos.
Obviously Konga, Donkey Kong, but it should have been called Donkey Bongo. But that doesn't quite work, I guess, does it?
There were three Donkey Konga games, and in each region, of course, these games actually had vastly different track listings.
Didn't one of them have, like, a Smash Mouth song or something?
The US/Canadian, so I guess just North American release, of two did, I believe.
And then there was stuff like Good Charlotte.
I loved the first disc in Japan. It had a lot of, like, Utada Hikaru.
Oh, yeah.
Had some really great classic Nintendo music.
The thing is, even though we're like, it had Smash Mouth in it, it's still so fun to play that you're like, okay, this is this terrible Smash Mouth song, but I'm having so much fun.
And, you know, to reference something that you had said about clapping, something else that was noteworthy was that this peripheral, the Konga drum, drums. I'm sorry, the bongo drums. You very pointedly in your show notes here pointed out that these are not conga drums, despite the title.
Mm-hmm.
Had a mic sensor on them so that you could clap and the game would register it, which was exciting.
Yeah, I mean, they're really responsive bongos. Ooh, hey.
Responsive bongos. And, of course, no discussion about this title would be complete without talking about Donkey Kong Jungle Beat, which was a rhythm-based platformer.
Yes.
One of my very favorite games of all time. Unfortunately, because of the peripheral and everything involved, a lot of people have never played that game.
And then they did put out a Wii version, though, right?
They did, yes. They did one New Play Control series.
Kind of like they did with Pikmin 2.
Like Pikmin
but,
and
the
Pikmin
thing
2.
Is that unlike Samba de Amigo, I can't see... I personally haven't played it, so I can't speak to it, but I can't see the experience being the same as actually hitting a drum.
Wait... Oh, gosh, you're talking about...
By using the Wiimotes.
Okay.
Whereas Wiimotes would be a good substitute for a maraca. I don't know how that compares to actually using the bongos.
Well, Rob, I see you reclining. Did you find the name of that
game? No, I never did. I couldn't find it. It's going to bug me, like, for the next week.
Well, do you have any Donkey Konga experiences?
Actually, I didn't really play this game. I kind of missed it. Like, I'm familiar with it. I think I saw it at, like, a party once, but I didn't really play a lot of it. I got to be honest. I think I kind of looked at it and I went, oh, it's Taiko no Tatsujin. I played that.
Yeah, I think that's actually a really, really, really fair way to approach that.
But it's a lot of fun. I understand it was different and had the better songs and so forth, but it is what it is.
Yeah. All right. Interesting. Well, who wants to talk about Lumines?
Me, because this game is fantastic. It's a Q Entertainment game, which means, of course, it's Mizuguchi. And it basically is kind of like a modern Tetris. It's that good. Like, there hasn't been a puzzle game as good as Tetris since Tetris. And then there's Lumines that comes out. And obviously, you know, this is the game that's the puzzle game where you have the two colors and the blocks, and you're trying to make 2x2 squares out of it as the beat meter goes by, right? And
so much fun.
The themes are a big part of it where, like, you know, some songs are slower and gives you more time to rack up points. Some songs are very fast. You know, I think probably Lumines on PSP with the Mondo Grosso songs are probably the most well-known. Lumines 2...
Licensed
on PSP.
Music, Missy Elliott, New Order.
Beck, No Doubt, right? Holla Back Girl,
like,
was the song.
That's basically like my personal playlist.
That was the king. That was like the best version, in my opinion.
And I think that's when I got my PSP, I think that's the one I picked up because of that reason.
The licensed tracks really added a lot, which is why it was really disappointing when the Xbox 360 version came out. They promised these licensed songs that were going to have the HD videos.
With the announcement, they had a Madonna video.
Yeah, well, at E3 one year, I played, it was Madonna's Sorry, and I played that in Lumines on the show floor, and then it never actually came out, so I was a little disappointed. And the controller on 360 really doesn't lend itself well to Lumines, unfortunately.
It does not.
So I felt really disappointed by the 360 release, but obviously they came out with the Vita version, which
Electronic
is,
Symphony?
Yeah, it's like the must-have Vita title.
There's a must-have Vita title?
Yes. If you're going to spend the money on a Vita, you might as well get Lumines, right?
Yeah. That was my attitude.
Unless you're going to rack up with PlayStation Plus games, which I wouldn't blame you for at all.
I'm just hating. I've even talked on this show about how even games like Army Corps of Hell did it for me, so I can't shade.
But and then there was, of course, the PlayStation 3's version as well, but it didn't really have any licensed music, but at least the controller's better. And it's really an iconic puzzle game.
A well-loved series now. I mean, you know, still probably like a little bit of a niche series, but, you know, I think just a testament to how amazing Mizuguchi-san is, and that he really made the best decision to go and form Q Entertainment, because they moved the rest of the UGA team to Sonic Team, and we know what happened with Sonic Team.
Now, I don't see it come up on your list, because I don't think it's as big of a music game, unless there's something you're going to talk about.
No, continue. I don't know what you're going to talk about.
Meteos was a game I kind of associate with Lumines, even though they're very different games. It is like my favorite DS game, period.
I have a point
love that, game.
That I want to hit on Lumines that I'm going to hit real quick, and then I want you to talk about Meteos, because I love that game. And I didn't even think about it, so it's not on this list. And that is, of course, the musical and visual project that Mizuguchi did for Lumines 2, Genki Rockets, which, of course, the song Heavenly Star is like an otaku anthem. It's played basically on loop in No More Heroes for like half the game.
Is it on Vogue Network during your musical?
Probably. That and Breeze, the B-side even, I think are both there. And those did make the 360 release.
Yes, fortunately. Were they add-on content?
Yes, it was DLC, and it's just like the one song. I think a remix came out at 1.2.
Oh man, Nintendo has brainwashed me. I'm calling DLC add-on content now. That's all. I just wanted to hit that side note real quick because I think it's really interesting that Mizuguchi basically created a virtual girl band so that he could produce this kind of power pop that he really likes to be in his games.
And they play live. Like, Genkai Rockets opened, like, I think they did, like, an Earth Day concert around the world in all these different cities, and Japan was, or Tokyo was one of them. And, like, Genkai Rockets was, like, the opening band for
yeah.
that.
Yeah. He assembled real singers to become this band that
he
created
an idea from.
I thought it was holograms.
Like, gorillas or something.
They are, but they have a real female vocalist for them now.
Got it.
Because I understand it to have initially been synthesizers and holograms.
Yeah. Very cool, though. Very cool.
Way before Tupac. Who has come up for the second time in this episode.
And it's all you, so stop.
And I didn't really want to say a whole lot else on Meteos. It isn't really a music game. It's just my love of Q Entertainment just grows with that game. Like, I was such a like a fanboy in the way that you're a Nintendo fanboy. I was like, I defended 99 Nights as not that bad, okay?
I like 99 Nights.
That was not
I don't
a bad
care.
Game.
I just bought that game like a year ago.
Really?
Yes.
But part of it's your love of Q Entertainment. And
no,
it's
absolutely.
Like, yeah, like I even say on OLR all the time, I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to openly admit it. I have a bias towards Q Entertainment, and if they put it out, I'm probably going to give it a better score overall. Like, it's just there's something we all go a little crazy for, if it's Star Wars or, you know, Doctor Who or Q Entertainment.
We're going to talk about them again in a minute, but I think that first we
actually I'm going to split this one up into two. First, Slagkick, you're going to talk about Os Tatake Oendan, and then Tim is going to talk about Elite Beat Agents.
Can't we talk about it at the same time?
No, because that would be confusing to our listeners.
I kind of wanted to talk about Elite Beat Agents.
I don't care what you want.
Because of the Ashley Simpson song.
I know why, but I don't care.
Makes me wanna la la. So, Osu Tatake Oendan, of course, is the DS game with manly cheerleaders. I see now why you wanted me to talk about Oendan specifically. And you know, it has unique touchscreen gameplay, which, not to blast into the future, but it kind of, theater rhythm, which we talk about a lot here, it kind of reminds me a lot of Oendan. Since Tim is going to talk about Elite Beat Agents in a minute. Oh, and this was developed by INIS.
Yeah,
which was what you had alluded to earlier.
Both of these games were really popular worldwide. Os Tatake Oendan had one of the highest import rates at the time.
Oh, like, I remember so because you imported it, and I remember playing on like the what is Download Play or whatever they call it.
Download Play, yeah.
That was my first exposure to it.
This is one of the few instances that I can recall where Nintendo really openly acknowledged importers having this game. Reggie has talked about it at media events, talked about how fan reaction to that was a big part of why Elite Beat Agents became a thing, about how these are some of his personal favorite DS titles. Obviously, you can't really talk about these games without talking about the breadth of licensed music for both the Japanese and American releases, sort of a lot of top 40 stuff, a lot of classics. Of course, you had the crazy little, like, cartoon comic scenarios.
Yeah, and like, in Oendan, it was the manly cheerleaders. They're kind of like, oh, we're going to help you with your personal life struggles and stuff.
You have diarrhea on a train. Let us help you get home. No, that was really one of the scenarios.
But, I mean, this is like, we're talking for the Japanese release, Larkin Ciel, Orange Range, Asian Kung Fu Generation. It's like a really great soundtrack.
There was a Ken Hirai song, right? Or was that in the second one?
Might have been the second one.
And this game is really notable to me in that a lot of people whom I don't typically think of as rhythm gamers really got into this game. I'm thinking in particular of Extifer, I think, was really into this.
Oh, yeah, he was really into this. He cleared the whole thing till he got to the unlock the cheerleaders at the very end. Yeah.
Excellent.
So,
why don't you tell us a little bit about Elite Beat Agents?
So Elite Beat Agents is the American version of Oendan. They changed a couple of things to make it a little more palatable for American audiences. Like, we don't really have the male cheerleader thing in our culture like they do in Japan, so they replaced them with secret agents who look very similar, but they sort of did the same thing. I loved the hell out of this game. This was the first game I bought when I bought my DS, because I came onto the DS bandwagon a little bit late. But there's so many great licensed songs in this game. They've got some Earth, Wind, and Fire. They've got some Jamiroquai, some David Bowie.
Got some Avril Lavigne.
Well, and this is exactly what I was talking about sort of the breadth of licensed music in this game. It was not just your typical music game. Oh, we have a couple of top 40 hits and then a bunch of original music. Like, these are like classics.
Yeah, they got some Queen. I mean,
you have Skater Boy by Avril Lavigne.
Oh, no, don't go there. So actually, you know, speaking of which,
see you later, boy.
There's some music I really hate in the world. Avril Lavigne is among it. But because I love this game so much, I made, like, suddenly I was okay with Skater Boy. I was okay with the Ashley Simpson song.
I had the same reaction.
Any other context, I would have, like, turned that shit off. Mm-hmm. But no, I can
one of
totally
the so you would have said previously that she wasn't good enough for you.
Don't even start with me.
One of the unlockable songs was "Do you believe in love after love after love after love?"
Are we in Land of the Lost right now? Like, what is
this? I think
I'm
going to need to apply an auto-tune filter in post-production for that.
I actually get to say that some of the because while you're doing these little rhythm puzzles, there's a story being told in sort of comic book form, and it unfolds as you do it correctly. If you make mistakes, then the story can branch a little bit, and it gets, you know, a little bit darker. And a couple of them,
having
like
diarrhea on the train.
Yes,
it's a real one.
Yeah, it is. A couple of them, like, really, like, got to me, like that. The Earth, Wind, and Fire song, I believe that there was
with
a little
the Christmas
story
theme of like the dead father.
Yeah,
something.
That like that gets me a little bit, you know, teary eyed. It really does.
Oh, it gives you a case of the feels. It really does.
Yeah. I'm
hopefully not a bad case of diarrhea on the train.
So, Rob,
I have one little anecdote, and I'm a very reserved person. I'm like, you know, I'm an introvert amongst extroverts.
I'm not.
I don't really lose my cool in public.
Yeah.
But when I finally finished that last Rolling Stones song, which was the last puzzle in the game, I had unlocked the hard mode with the female cheerleaders. I was on a plane, and I had been trying it for like 50 times in a row. I was getting really frustrated. I finally beat that game, and I like stood up and shouted. I was by myself on a plane full of people, and they all looked at me. And it was such an out-of-character moment for me, but I was so excited to beat that game.
Well, oh, God, I wish I could see that.
Well, that was why I wanted him to
the
do
elite
this.
Beat
sit
agents.
Down, sir. Sit down, sir.
The elite beat agents helped you overcome your personal struggles on an airplane.
They totally did. It was that was the metagame of it. The Elite Beat Agents were fixing my life.
Rob, I'm going to have you take this next one, and I'm only moving us forward because we're going long already. And
can I just say I'm really pissed off they have not done another Elite Beat Agents, especially when the Wii U is the perfect platform for it.
It really is. Mm-hmm. There was Oandon 2, but I need an Elite Beat Agents,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, that doesn't count for us here in the U.S., though. Yeah,
Bitch, I imported. Why didn't you?
I don't know, because importing is expensive. All right, the next game on the list, of course, as I said, Q Entertainment. I have a huge bias for them.
I thought you said you have a huge boner for them.
Oh, I did that too.
Both.
Every Extend Extra on the PSP was a thing. And it was they say it was more like a rhythm shoot 'em up, but if I remember, it's been a while since I played this game, and I probably played more of the one that's on Xbox Live Arcade, which is E4, the Every Extend Extra Extreme. That's the one that's about really setting off the chain reactions.
Mm-hmm. That is my favorite.
You hit the button for the detonation, and it's like, it explodes, and it explodes the asteroids near it, and then it starts all going off of the music. And then it's like this whole like asteroids thing where more things are flying, and you might set off this huge chain reaction that goes on for like an hour. I think,
yeah,
I had it happen
literally
on Xbox
an hour.
Once.
It has a timer. Mm-hmm. As the explosion goes on, more explosions happen more quickly. And mm-hmm. the goal is to get one that sort of just self-perpetuates and goes on for, yeah, you know, 42, 45 minutes, more an hour. Mm-hmm. The most I've ever gotten was like 45 minutes.
But yeah.
I think I was there for one of those times. And I was like, oh my God.
And yet you can just sit there and watch it. Amazing on a mind-altering substance. Not that I would condone that, but, you know, if you have a little liquor, it's
well, I was just going to say, like, what do you think we do?
Y'all need Jesus.
I don't think he's in the game.
That would be great. An unlockable Jesus. All of the little spaceships become
space
little crosses.
Jesus.
Rock me, sexy Jesus.
He died for your sins. You've got to believe us.
Wow.
This is why we're friends.
And last, but most certainly
well,
not
maybe
least,
there's a rhythm Jesus in rhythm heaven.
Holy crap, Slack Kick. Well played.
Also known as Rhythm Tengoku, which was a GBA title developed by, I believe that was the first party title by Nintendo, right? One of their teams.
This girl is on fire.
This girl is on fire.
Ladies and gentlemen, the girl on fire.
Don't let it go to your head.
And it was developed by Yoshio Sakamoto, who is best known as the WarioWare dude. And it's just a quirky little collection of rhythm mini games doing actions in sync to a beat.
Well, and you know, this game is often compared to the WarioWare games because they are also sort of micro games, but they're like rhythm micro games.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you know, this game has... Your notes are wrong.
Sorry.
This game has actually been released worldwide, like all of them, I think.
Really? Because when I was doing research, I saw that we didn't get anything until Rhythm Heaven, Rhythm Tengoku Gold.
Oh, the GBA version I don't think came out here, but Rhythm Tengoku I know did, and Rhythm Heaven Fever.
Maybe I imported it with while literally not realizing I was importing.
It might have come out like way later. I want to say one of them came out way after it was out in Japan.
Because that came out at that same time as like Hexadrive and a bunch of really weird, quirky GBA games.
Yeah.
And I felt like they all came over later on.
To the wiki.
All right. Anyway, do you want to finish talking about Rhythm Tengoku?
You know, I just was going to kind of open it up to see what anyone else had to add to it.
Sadly, I don't have a lot to add to this. I've played these games, but not a lot of them. I haven't owned them, so...
That's kind of my experience,
I don't dislike them. It's just, you know, lots of games to play. But it's always fun to see Nintendo kind of getting in on the music game fun.
Yeah.
Oh, apparently it was only released in Japan. Hmm. I imported it without knowing that I would have been... importing.
God, you buy so much shit you can't even remember where you got it anymore.
That's a little problematic. It was also, while I'm at it, apparently the last Nintendo developed game for the Game Boy Advance.
Although, you know, then like all of those movie tie-ins, like I don't know, probably like DreamWorks.
We're not made by Nintendo.
I'm just saying that there were still GBA games like for years, and you're like, why is this on GBA?
Well, you know, Spyro Eternal Knight came out in that time window, and that's a legitimately great game, so I don't...
Now I'm talking about themes that are like Madagascar, The Island Escape,
Hotel Transylvania.
No, girl, I don't think that's for GBA, but it's probably on DS.
Yes.
And 3DS and Wii and Wii U.
With that having been said, we are going to get into our next section of discussion, the inevitable rise and fall of the Bemani brand. You know, we're going to sort of look at the events of 1997 to... you know, more or less present, question mark. And I think this discussion of Bemani as a brand really starts with the release of the Beatmania arcade game.
Well, yes, because that's where the name comes from, right?
Yeah, right.
Bemani, Beatmania.
That was, of course, you know, in 1997. And I want to ask one of you to talk about Beatmania, and I feel like there's really one person that I kind of have to ask.
Well, yeah, talking about the original Beatmania?
Yes.
Okay. It was actually released here in the U.S. Called
Hip-Hop Mania.
Which was a little silly because there's so many different genres in there. I honestly think that was some marketing department's idea on how to make it hip and cool in the U.S. But anyway, that was really a later mix of the game that they kind of adapted into that. But Beatmania, of course, five buttons,
five and three.
Yeah, it was three on the bottom row, two on the top row, white and black keys, kind of like a keyboard. And then you had a turntable, which is, you know, where the hip hop comes from, because, you know, a turntable, it's wiggity whack, y'all.
Wiggity 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 whack.
But, you know, the notes fall down and then you hit the buttons in time to the music and you're making like the bass beats. And then as the songs get more complicated, you're playing melodies and doing the scratch, you know, samples and so forth. You know, the early mixes of this game probably had maybe like seven or eight songs, and it was more about the presentation and the giant cabinets they were in with the light and the noise and everything. But it was the first game that kind of started, you know, this whole genre that Konami developed, which I'm sure a lot of listeners are like, why did you leave all these games out of your previous discussion? Because a whole segment just for Konami and what they did.
And that's absolutely, you know, we didn't talk about this during the origins of rhythm gaming. We didn't talk about this during quirky games, because this is really almost like the story of rhythm games as we know them now.
Yes.
Is Bemani.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, I came in during the PS1 era. I had a you know, off-brand Beatmania controller with the turntable. It would always stick, and the, you know, the three buttons and the two buttons. And I fell in love with it as soon as I discovered that there was a, like, E3 remixed Metal Gear Solid theme.
Yes.
Big bass mix
track.
And that was, you know, kind of early in the game. And I just, as soon as I played this, I knew that it was big in Japan. I didn't know anything about the game itself. Mm-hmm. As soon as I popped it into my import PlayStation, I was just like, yep, this is incredible. I need to get Bimani everything.
It was a home release in Japan. They did have a special peripheral for it that had the same key layout with the turntable. But, you know, we never got it in the U.S. We sort of got a wink and a nod to it later on. I'll talk about that when we get there. But
the PS2 one.
Yeah, it was a little weird. And, you know, we'll talk about that later on. But they kind of had to play catch up in some regards because they just skipped us because, for whatever reason, they felt we wouldn't be into it, which... You know, I think they made the wrong choice, but it's easy to say that in retrospect.
I agree. And, you know, even with Hip Hop Mania, they had machines for that at, you know, the golf lands of the Bay Area, Paramount's Great America at the time. Mm-hmm.
Well, it was an impressive machine.
Yeah, it was gigantic.
And you didn't see a lot like it in arcades. I mean, you're making music. What other kind of arcade games did that? You know, yes, there was Parappa and Samba and some of the games we talked about before that had arcade releases. You didn't see that break into the mainstream here.
No, and you would walk up to any arcade that had this machine. There would always be someone playing, someone doing, you know, Prince on a Star or something.
Yeah.
And there'd be like a whole crowd of people like getting into it.
Yeah, which is amazing that they never did the home releases here. But I'm pretty sure there's reasons for that.
Peripheral something something.
I think too, just stubbornness of thinking the game wouldn't work here. I think there was a big fear, and I think in this industry you have to take risks to get ahead, and I think Konami was not willing to take those risks for a very long time. And when they did, it was, you know, which we talk about DDR in a little bit, you know, was kind of really bare bones. I mean, it really was up to the fans to demand that we get it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting to me that in the context that these things did reach our shores, a lot of importers were buying these games, buying these controllers, mostly these off-brand controllers for Beatmania and other games that we'll get to later were made by, like, Red Octane, who ultimately jump-started this entire genre
yes.
in the U.S.
Yep, yep.
So I absolutely agree with you that it was... obviously a poor decision on Konami's choice. They literally created a genre for other people to profit on. But you know, Beatmania itself, I don't really know why I pronounce that word that way, but I don't care. was a huge hit in Japan. The arcade game was super popular. Are you watching Adventure Time while we record?
Somebody just got called out.
No.
Now, do you guys bring up later Beatmania 2DX and Beatmania 3 and so forth and those?
No, so
I think Slagkick at one point called it IIDX.
No, it's 2DX. It's stylized.
One of my favorite Beatmania 2DX titles is songs is Changing to Asia.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's got, like, a very Bollywood sort of feel to it.
Well, here's the thing, okay? So the games will have different mixes. So, like, you have Beatmania just by itself, and Beatmania second mix, Beatmania third mix, Beatmania fourth mix, and I think it went all the way up to seventh mix, and then there was a final. There might have been another game in there. But then you had, okay, so you had that series, but while that's going on, once it got to about three or four, they released the first version of Beatmania 2 Deluxe, which was the seven-key version, which you had four whites on the bottom, three on the top, and you had the turntable, and I'm thinking, like, couldn't you flip it, or was that only the home? Oh, yeah, no, it faced, depending on if you were on the one-player side or the two-player side, you had the turntable on the left or on the right.
Yes.
And so when they released the home version, they actually had a controller where you could flip around the key set, and you could have the turntable on either side.
The first time I saw that done, I was so impressed.
Yes, and that was the best Bimani game they ever put out. I mean, I think anybody you ask is either going to say DDR or 2DX. I mean, it's one or the other.
Yeah.
I mean, just, you know, that was when they kind of upped it to DVD from CD, so you really had some full motion video that went with it. The music, especially in the beginning, so good. this series is still going on in arcades in Japan.
Yeah, absolutely.
What I think they're on 20, which is Linkle. So they're on 20th mix. I mean, they don't call them that. They don't really call them that anymore. They all get subtitles. But some people will still call it, like, oh, what are we on, 20th mix now? So, I mean, these games keep going. I think they stopped finally. You know, these games were coming out on PlayStation 2 in Japan. And I think Princess was the last one, which was 16, I think. And they did, like, a Princess Plus Best Of, which had all the greatest hits from the past. But it really sucks that they don't have the later ones. They haven't tried to do it on PlayStation 3 or something. It just, again, Konami's...
money on the table.
Well, peripherals are expensive. Sony didn't really make it easy to take something you did on the PlayStation 2 and put it on the PlayStation 3 in regards to those peripherals. So I can't really fault them for thinking there might not be the audience out there, especially when the U.S. didn't buy up Beatmania.
Yeah.
Which was really Beatmania 2D. I mean, this is fucking confusing at this point, right? We get Beatmania in the U.S. on the PlayStation 2 with a controller that's actually better than Japan's.
Yes.
Because they fixed the key sticking issue by making the keys a little different, right? But we get Beatmania, which is really like our own version of Beatmania 2DX 9th style. So it has like a splattering of those songs, a splattering of Best Of,
some
and then
really
a random 5-key mode. Sorry.
Well, I was going to say there was also some really great... North American, as far as I'm aware, exclusive licensed songs.
See, here's the thing. This is where Konami, again, wasn't willing to take the risk. Sure, we had Toxic by Britney Spears in this game, right? It wasn't really Britney Spears. It was a cover band doing Toxic.
You know, I was
not
specifically
as cool.
Thinking of that, like, Brian Eno, Brian Molko crossover song.
Oh.
The name escapes me. It was like White Sky or something.
Yeah, yeah. No, they had covers, and it's just not the same. You know what I mean?
But that's up until later on, and we saw that more in the like Guitar Hero days, and we'll talk about that later. A lot of this was cover music, though, right?
In Japan, yes. But it was I don't know, like, it's different.
Well, again, Slykick, we are talking for this specific Beatmania release in the U.S., this was PS2 era, sort of later days. Mm. Guitar Hero had sort of set the precedent already at this point for licensed music and master tracks.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Which, you know, and I'm probably getting ahead of myself here. When we get to Rock Revolution, which was a game that, you know, Konami tried to kind of catch. It was so weird. Konami, like, you know, Harmonix did this amazing rock band and, you know, guitar. They did the first two Guitar Hero games, right?
So actually. They did Rocks the 80s as well.
Oh, yeah, right. Rocks the 80s. You know, so they basically, you know, kind of one-up the genre in some ways. And so Konami kind of copied a copy or, you know, inspired by. And it was shit. I mean, Rock Revolution was just such shit. And one of the big reasons was because, again, it was all covers.
Yes, and, you know, in some ways it was useful in that they were able to get a couple of songs. Spirit of the Radio at the time was a huge requested track that nobody had because of master track issues, and they were using covers, so they were able to get it. You know, some Pantera, they had a Pantera song that was like that.
Yeah.
And so there's some merit, but for the most part, like, this was a really awful choice.
One or two songs isn't enough, which is kind of the problem overall.
Yeah. And that's why you can now find it at GameStop for like 59 cents.
if it's even still on the shelves and not in a landfill in New Mexico somewhere by now.
Hanging out with E.T.
Which they're digging up. Did you hear us talk about that a couple episodes back? Yeah.
He probably didn't hear us talking about it. He probably talked about it on his own show.
We kind of had the same story, but that's all right.
I want to talk about all of the iterations of Beatmania right now. The way this is structured, I think it just makes more sense. We've already sort of done that, but if you have anything else Beatmania specific, the game, not the genre, I'd like to get it in now.
There was a Beatmania 3. I think they only ever did one release, and its little extra thing was that it had a foot pedal.
Oh,
as like an effector. Yeah, you had like, you know, your little bass drum or whatever, so you could use the foot pedal, which was also an effector pedal in some stages. That did not get a home release, and I believe they only ever had one version of it in arcades. Beatmania 3 did not. I don't know if it's because they went back down to 5 keys or what it was. Maybe just, you know, people weren't into feet play. I don't know.
Whoa. But you were.
It was fun. I'll try it once.
You into a little foot play?
And Beatmania 3 apparently also has a unique feature in the Bimani series, a 3.5-inch floppy disk drive.
That's right. Yeah, we never really got use out of that here in the States, but yes.
So it had floppies and feet?
Feet and floppies.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, no, it had gone to the five back to the 5 keys. And it lived for two iterations, it looks like, Beatmania 3 and then Beatmania 3 the Final in 2002.
Oh, I didn't realize there was a second version.
Well, I mean, to get to the Final in your second iteration is not really a good sign.
You know, I think they put Beatmania 3 the Final. Now that you say that, Beatmania 3 relied pretty heavily on a lot of tracks from the original Beatmania. I'm pretty sure Beatmania 3 the Final came out to coincide with Beatmania the Final, and I think they have a lot of crossover.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right, we're going to talk here about two... why are these grouped together? Oh, just because they're the same year. Okay, we're going to talk about these two in separate talking points. In 1998, two more Bimani games came out. This was sort of a diversification of the brand. Oh, girl, three. And that third one is like the big major one. I'm hella dumb.
Let's talk about poppin' music first, though.
Well, in 1998, three new games came out of the Bimani series, which was now a brand, diversifying this entire game music rhythm thing that Konami had established themselves as. Of course, I'm talking about Poppin' Music, Guitar Freaks, and Dance Dance Revolution. We're going to talk about Poppin', we're going to talk about Guitar Freaks, and then we're mostly just going to listen to Rob talk about Dance Dance Revolution. He clearly has, you know, the most to say about it. And I kind of feel like we're going to try to mine him for some unique stories. I'm saying this out loud so that he can start thinking about unique stories. Poppin' Music, of course, is well known for just its massive array of buttons. It is a nine-button game. That's nine, right?
Two, three, four, seven or nine?
Thank you. No, it's not seven. It might have a seven play mode, but...
Oh, yeah, that's probably what I do.
Oh, because you're super basic. No, Poppin' is a very accessible game. The track lists are largely based typically on like current J-pop, a lot of anime music in the more recent iterations.
The one in Japantown in San Francisco has like Cha La, Head Cha La. It has
Tank
from Cowboy Bebop. It has Cruel Angel's Thesis from Evangelion. It has like some Mario stuff. And just so much fun to play. Like Captain Spike said, really accessible even for someone like me who, you know, is not used to the tight window of Bimani timing.
Well, it has a very light aesthetic. There's a lot of bright primary colors, very cartoony, lots of very mascot-based, very cute little animals. I have always gotten the impression, and I feel like Rob is probably going to slap me down when I say this, but I always got the impression that this was meant to be the entry-level Bimani game.
I would say maybe the more child-oriented one, certainly, but entry-level, this game can get hideously difficult.
Oh, I didn't mean to imply that it doesn't. That's one of my favorite things about it.
It's a little more kid-focused, I think, in especially in some of the song selections. The fact they had a version that was nothing – it was Poppin' Music Anime Lo that was nothing but anime songs. You know, I kind of get the sense it was more like a child-focused game. But, of course, many of the otaku over here love that, so.
Well, you know, it's funny that you say that. I was just going to talk about a very dear friend of mine who has a custom-built Poppin' controller. And so he plays all of the songs on, like, hardest difficulty, and he just, like, is slamming the thing. Like, I literally cannot, like, move my body that fast as he's, like, pressing buttons. And so, like... It gets really hardcore in the harder difficulties, is my point.
I'm going to be honest, and this is not a popular opinion, and I will get judged for it, but I kind of think Poppin' Music's super basic as far as the Bimani series goes. Like, I do not like it nearly as much as I do Beatmania 2DX, which, I mean, the games are so similar. I mean, sure, Poppin' has nine keys, and they're all, like playing with trouble with the Pop-O-Matic bubble, like nine of them, right?
Yes.
And
yep.
That's why I love it.
They're like those little dome lights.
But that's... And to me, it's kind of like, oh, you know, you play it once and then LOL, it's over. You know, there was a home release of Poppin' Music here in the U.S. It was on Xbox Live Arcade and it was called Beat and Groovy. And
you were going to talk about the Wii release that we got here in the U.S.
No, there was that too. But the reason why I bring up the Xbox Live one is it's atrocious. It is bad. There is no controller for it. There's maybe like nine songs. I literally feel like this game was aborted while it was in development, and somebody took that abortion of a game and put it out there on the marketplace for everybody to download.
A motherfucking abortion.
That's really what this game is, and I'm sorry if this description offends or whatever, but this game is an abortion. Like, it is a terrible, terrible game, and it's like it exemplifies all that was wrong with Konami of Japan's thoughts about what they could get away with in the U.S. and what, you know, we talked about the value of a game and what your money should get you earlier. And, you know, even $10 on Xbox Live Arcade should not be buying this crap. It was terrible.
And what game was this called again?
Beat and Groovy, and it did not translate to controller well at all. The songs were meh, and, you know, sure, it had online play, but whatever. I'm sure it's delisted by now.
Well, and, you know, it's funny that you say that, because to me, one of the interesting things about Poppin', and I'm going to get away from Beat and Groovy now, because I know you don't want to talk about it. You look so mad right now.
That game makes me mad. As somebody who supported this series from, you know, 1999, 2000 until now, that game makes me mad.
But I notice that Poppin' is one of those series that still gets releases on, like, PSP in Japan even now.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly there is a way to map the Poppin' control scheme to a controller.
Yeah.
And you're saying that for Beat and Groovy, they just didn't do that.
Keep in mind, there's a big difference between a 360 controller and a Sony controller as well. And five-button mapping works fine on the controller to me. Nine-button mapping, I think, is pushing it. But some people will do it and play it and love it, and good on them. But don't forget the PSP also, you know, like DJ Max and some of these other games do very well on the PSP.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's just more of an audience for it in Japan in the portable market than there really is here.
I gotta say, I'm looking at this game on Wikipedia right now, and it has some hilariously bad art. It looks like Bratz Rejects.
It's part of the reason I don't personally care for the game. I know it has this audience, and they're probably mad at me for slamming the game right now, but next to Beatmania 2DX's visuals, you have these stupid dancing characters, and that's like all the interaction, you know, audio or visual interaction you get is really derpy to me.
So you have a problem going from the really highly sophisticated, really cool techno visual design and going to this sort of user interface of like Bratz gone
Leotarded. Yes.
Thank you.
Let's get it started.
I don't like using that term, and I almost did, and I feel really bad. I'm going to move forward from Poppin'. I personally am a Poppin' fan. I think it's just a lot of fun. It's one of my favorite Bimani games to just roll into an arcade and just be like, oh, kinda I like, want a light, fun game.
It makes me think of like musical whack-a-mole.
I'll play the machine if it's there.
I can identify with that, because for all that I talk about building my own custom Poppin' controller, I have been talking about doing this for like 6 years and I haven't. So that's how driven I am. Let's talk about Guitar Freaks, because I feel like it's very clear where a discussion of Guitar Freaks leads, so let's not take it all the way. Let's just talk a little bit about Guitar Freaks.
Beatmania was a plastic instrument game, if you want to get technical, but in terms of like instrument, like musical instrument, Guitar Freaks was kind of the first. It was really the first, and I mean,
Guitar Freaks really basically was Beatmania, but with more guitar-focused songs. The notes scrolled up, and instead of a turntable, you had the whole tilt the guitar to do the little
star
power, whatever it was, and that was it. I mean, it really was basically the same game otherwise.
No, absolutely.
Just with different tracks. I mean, that's not a bad thing.
No, you know, I loved it. I imported it. I got, you know, some of those awful Red Octane cheapy guitars.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I was definitely very clearly here for it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really interesting that Konami really failed. Man, I feel really awful. I'm realizing now that any discussion on Beatmania involves the phrase, how Konami failed.
Well, it's the reality, unfortunately, is that somebody else had to do the idea and make it better, you know?
They didn't capitalize on what makes guitar music and rock music unique. Mm-hmm. It's just Beatmania with a skin and a different controllers mapped in a different way, basically.
It's like, oh, and you can play the Rurouni Kenshin theme music.
Sobakasu, yay!
They did release, actually, Guitar Freaks had its first arcade release. I believe there is a U.S.-branded version of that.
There is. It has way fewer songs, though. It's like Fire and like three songs,
exactly.
And that's it.
Exactly! There's the problem! Why, when you have all these songs, but why do you limit it so much?
Well, I have to assume it was for licensing, but if you put the money out for so that you make a better product, people will respond better.
And that's the risk Konami consistently failed to take.
You know, we're very blessed here. Most of us are from the Bay Area. These import Japanese machines were in all of the arcades here for years.
They're even up here in Sac, and I've seen them around the country too. You know, especially the later version. I think they're still going.
They are, yes.
Yeah, Guitar Freaks is up to like X5 or something now. They're still going.
They've slowed down compared to some of the other ones that are still going, but they still pop out every couple years.
Now, I think one of the coolest things about Guitar Freaks, and I know I might be getting ahead of myself, so I apologize, but deal with it.
You are, but I was going to shake my finger at him for structuring this that way so it works out well.
All right, so
I was just going to suggest we talk about those other two games.
Okay, so we have Drum Mania comes along later, right? Which is, okay, it's Guitar Freaks with drums. Ta-da, yep. Right? And then later on, you even get Keyboard Mania. Well, when Guitar Freaks and Drum Mania were out, those two games would session together.
Uh-huh. Session play, yep.
You could play. One person's on the guitar is playing the song, and then one person's on the drums playing the song.
And yeah, Captain Spike and I did that a couple times.
Yeah, later on with Keyboard Mania, they added that to the mix. Unfortunately, Keyboard Mania only ever saw three mixes come out, but it was my favorite. I loved Keyboard Mania, and I was really pressed they never did more than the three games.
Well, the Golflands down in the Bay Area, both Milpitas and Sunnyvale, had all three of these machines for concurrent mixes. Mm-hmm. It would not be uncommon for me to get a group of people together and be like, you're going to take drums, I will take guitar, you take keyboards, and we would rock out all night. We'd end up spending $50 to $100 a night on this thing.
Yeah, and we would do the same thing up here in Sac, you know, the little group of friends that we had, because we had all three for a short time, too. But then, you know, that one time we caught that woman changing her baby's diaper on the Keyboard Mania machine.
Oh, I think really, no.
That really happened. I think kind of personifies, like... a lot of what Konami did to their franchise. That's not Konami's fault. That's more of the arcade's fault.
No, but it is like a metaphor for what Konami did.
Yeah, to that
change
series.
The big dirty diaper.
Well, Keyboard Mania is hard. It's a hard game.
It is a hard game.
It's a hard sell. But you know, they did turn it into, there was like a PC game later on. I think that was like a teach you how to play piano type of thing. They were able to turn it into. Very disappointing, but epic to play Akumajo Dracula Medley on Keyboard Mania.
Yes, me.
I mean, amazing. Oh,
me, Christy, and some people that you don't know would do that exactly that.
Keyboard Mania also had the effector wheel instead of the turntable, and I think that was really shoved down our throats and not needed. Like, Konami kind of felt like, oh, well, we need something to add to it. Like we've
you
got
already
the turntable.
Have 20 keys. Yeah. Maybe that's enough.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But rest in peace, Keyboard Mania, which did have a PlayStation 2 release. I imported that. I think it's actually sitting over in there, or was sitting over there. Where the hell is my Keyboard Mania? I have it somewhere.
That is awesome.
Yeah, I love that game.
Oh, man. I even imported, again, the home releases of not Keyboard Mania, but, you know, like Gita Dora, the Guitar Freaks drum combination. Mm-hmm. I had the Red Octane ripoff controllers. Mm-hmm. And we would totally do, like, session play for, like, Alanis, You Oughta Know.
Yeah,
yes.
Bad MIDI cover as though it was.
Yeah.
And so, absolutely, you know, and again, I really want to point out that I only bring this up in this context that Konami had a real hit on their hands. American audiences would have eaten this up.
If they had marketed it
you
right.
You know it.
Done it right.
You know it. That those guys from Harmonix did that exact same thing we were just talking about. They went and did the session play with keyboard... hello, look what they added in Rock Band 3. Hello. They tried, right?
They brought a keyboard in.
Bless their heart. They tried. I mean, they added the vocals to it, obviously. You know that was inspired by session playing.
Oh, it has to have been.
Konami could have had that. Konami could have had Rock Band. Instead, they have Rock Revolution.
It's basically like Konami was kind of the Madonna. They were great for a while, but then missed so many opportunities, and then Harmonix was the Lady Gaga. Who stepped in.
That's a very controversial
opinion
over there.
I'm not
going
to comment on that for so many reasons. and, you know, it's interesting.
I'm sorry.
We
anything
are gonna
after
talk
Confessions
about
on the dance floor is utter crap.
You know, we are going to talk about this, of course, but I'm going to skip ahead just a little here because it's really prudent to bring it up in this context. Harmonix ended up making Karaoke Revolution for Konami.
Yes.
And ultimately, they literally kept that game engine and used it in Rock Band later.
Yep. Yes.
Mm-hmm. They literally worked with Konami to develop these incredible rhythm games. Konami failed to capitalize on what they had with even Karaoke Revolution, And so Harmonix.
Oh, but they had the American Idol franchise. That's all they needed, right? That's what Karaoke Revolution
you
turned
go,
into.
Dog.
I remember one time,
and then Glee.
Oh God! And then okay, what Karaoke Revolution, American Idol? It had Simon. It had Randy,
but
then
it didn't have Paula.
It didn't have Paula. It had another girl.
But she was basically the same. She's like, I'm voting yes, 100% yes.
Yeah,
going to Hollywood. Round.
Her name was like Pamela or something like. Oh my God! Like. Is so obvious what's going on here.
And yet they had Paula Abdul music, because I remember singing Straight Up.
I remember singing Straight Up. Straight Up, now tell me. I remember, I do have to say that as much as we might poke fun at that, Captain Spike and I had a memorable experience.
We had like a million memorable experiences.
But the most memorable one is when we were doing an idol competition, and it was, did we do a duet or something? And it based us based on our like, whoever got the higher score on the duet, and it was Natasha Bedingfield's Unwritten.
So also coming out in
1998... Feel the rain on your skin.
Cool story, bro.
Also coming out in 1998, and, you know, in many ways, the reason why I podcast, it, you know, through a very nebulous sort of set of connections, is Dance Dance Revolution. Tim, why don't you tell us about Dance Dance Revolution?
I'm the wrong person to talk about this game. I never played DDR until very recently due to...
I think that makes you the right person.
Okay. I never wanted to play it. I always felt super self-conscious dancing in an arcade. I always got secondhand embarrassment watching other people play it. Rob...
Okay.
Oh, you know, just this guy who's been sitting here and kind of had a... online radio show based on...
Well, the reason... What I really wanted here, of course, from you was a description of how the game works so that then Rob could launch into a discussion of the politics and circumstances surrounding the game and its success.
Okay, so it's a rhythm game, and there's a mat that you're on, and there are directions. There's a up, down, left, right, and you have to step on the correct panel at the correct time, so it looks like you're dancing. That's sort of it in a nutshell.
And if you're fat like me, it's really difficult.
This was, of course, one of those games that, as we were talking about with Guitar Freaks and Hip Hop Mania, it did get a U.S. release in a pared-down version, fewer songs brought over. Mm-hmm. But this was something that I think probably everyone can remember, you know, like... The president was talking about it for fitness days. It got to a point where at its height it was being used in school fitness programs.
It still is. I mean, if you saw Konami's, they were at like an arcade show recently or something. They were showing off that Classroom Edition. DDR lives on in that.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about Dance Dance Revolution?
Well, I mean, I could say so much about it. I could tell you about the first time I saw it. Is the first time I ever saw it was when I was actually at Milpitas Golfland randomly. Like, we were going to see a midnight showing of Shock Treatment, the not quite sequel to Rocky Horror Picture Show, right, with live Shadowcast. And we went to a nearby arcade in the area, which was Milpitas Golfland. And I saw these guys all dancing on this machine, but it was so cool. Like, the songs that were coming out of it were really, like, cheesy but awesome, and the machine just lit up. And these guys were, like, freestyling. Like, they weren't just dancing on this. They were, like, doing dances. I'm pretty sure, in retrospect, because this was Memorial Day weekend, I'm pretty sure we walked in on a DDR tournament going on in that arcade. So that was the first time I ever saw a DDR. And... So later, fast forward to the year 2000, I'm in Las Vegas for the 25th anniversary Rocky Horror Picture Show convention with Princess Irene and my friend Jessica, who went on to be Iguana Girl, one of the moderators, and I think admin for a short time at DDR Freak.
Oh, wow.
So we actually played that. We saw the machine in the arcade and we were like, oh, we have to play this. Like, look, you guys, it's like Busta Groove. But it's like, you're the controller. Like, we have to play this, right? And I'm like, oh my God, I love that Butterfly song. Who doesn't love that song? So I had to get on this machine. So we got up there and played. And, you know, those machines had very limited selection in the beginning.
Yes.
So I think we play, Have You Never Been Mellow? And I was like, this song's easy. Then we move up to Boom Boom Dollar. And it's like, okay, I barely passed it. And then you get to Butterfly, which is like a whole 3 feet in difficulty. And it got more difficult. But We played that in the arcade at Circus Circus like all night. We didn't even bother going to Friday's convention, like the evening part. We didn't go to the evening part because we were too busy playing DDR. We were like, they're just doing a shadow cast of Rocky Horror. We've seen that a million times. Let's just stay here and bond as a cast and play DDR all night. And we did. And we kind of took that energy back home. We heard that Roseville Golfland got a machine, a DDR USA, and we were there like two, three times a week playing this game. And I swear I've never been skinnier in my life.
Yep. You know, we got the same story, girl, preach it.
I thought you were going to say, I met you and you were skinny. And what happened?
A DDR fourth mix came out. We got that. And that was epic because there's so many more songs in the game. And that just really led to the community. It's like the arcades had this rebirth because of DDR community. Now, I don't want to say, you know, fighting games have definitely had their thing. You had Soul Calibur 2, Capcom versus SNK 2 were both very huge. You had racing games later on. Initial D came in, you know, so they had their community too. But, you know, you kind of, you had between the fighting games, the dance games, and the racing games, you had a reason to go to the arcade.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Which, unfortunately, as we know now, is just not the case anymore. And it's really, I mean, fighting games a little bit, yes, but so much of that is online now. And, you know, racing games, mm-hmm. not so much, you know, so it's sad. But.
It's so funny to me that you brought up Milpitas Golfland, because I have played on that very machine that you're talking about, having seen these people play on. My first experience with that game was at that exact same location. And it got to the point that we would drive out multiple times a week, even though that was like a 30-mile drive for us. We would drive out multiple times a week to play this game, get Jamba Juice, and then play some more. Until we got one at a arcade local to my house, and then I would rollerblade to it, even though it was like 10 miles away. I'd rollerblade to it literally every day just to play more and more all day nonstop.
We would still drive quite often to the Bay Area to go play these machines and go to tournaments. Like, I went to a big Milpitas Golfland tournament. I was there the infamous night that some dipshit threw the bag of flour everywhere and like ruined stuff. You know,
I heard about that.
Like a very Gallagher moment. Actually, Dark Sakura and I kind of did our infamous. We were very pissed that we lost in Perfect Attack tournament so easy because the sun was glaring on the machine in a way I wasn't used to. So we were like, let's enter freestyle and let's just be hella stupid. So we went to Walgreens and bought these gigantic orange bats, and we did Stomp to My Beat, and we just did a freestyle where we basically played the song, and we're like looking at the screen half the time, but during the music breaks, we turn around and just beat each other with the orange bats. And we ended up like all signing the bat, and I think we gave it away in a contest.
And that's why the show was originally called Orange Bat Radio.
Not quite. Orange Lounge Radio, though, did come from DDR, obviously, because Orange Lounge is one of the bands that did songs. And we thought, you know, like a Beatles tribute band would call themselves Yellow Submarine, or like a Journey, you know, tribute band calls themselves, you know, Separate Ways or whatever, right? So we call ourselves Orange Lounge Radio. Yeah.
Excellent. That is awesome.
I don't know what else to say about DDR. I could go on and on for another 3 hours about DDR.
I have a really big question.
I'm happy for that. Someday in the future, probably it's going to have it's probably going to have to be some number of weeks in the future. Dance Revolution episode.
It'll be a Game Buoy macro.
Just talk about Dance Dance Revolution.
A Game Buoy macro. Because it's not a micro. I have a question.
Okay.
When do you think...
Like you both have questions.
When do you think that Dance Dance Revolution jumped the shark? Or when do you think was the downhill point for it?
Releasing DDR Extreme and then not doing anything about it for years and years.
Yeah. I still see that machine all over the place.
Konami taking that big break really did them in. I think the other thing that really hurt Konami is that the Xbox versions were superior to anything else. Not so much the first one, but the Ultramix 2 and Ultramix 3 were literally, that was how you do a fucking DDR game in the US.
Yes.
And a lot of that had to do with music selection, because it was really a crossbreed of these songs are kind of the popular fan favorites from the Japanese mixes, and we have an indie dance label out of Salt Lake City we're going to license all these songs from. And that was part of the great thing about like Dance Dance Revolution third mix, and even getting into the game in the first place, is that you're discovering all these new, like, whoever in the state, whoever would have heard of Captain Jack outside of, you know, Doctor Who or Erotic or Smile DK, who would have ever heard of that here if not for DDR? And the really cool thing about the Xbox versions is it brought us, you know, Echo Image and, you know, some of the really cool synth pop bands. Like, I became a bigger fan of synth pop because of DDR Ultramix and the Xbox series. And I think, honestly, the mistake that Konami made is that that team should have developed a US arcade mix.
No, absolutely. I completely agree.
Missed opportunity, big time.
But we got Extreme.
Well, then finally, Supernova was the mix we got.
Supernova was pretty good.
I actually really liked that. But
yeah, but But for such a break and for such the pomp and fanfare of we are starting over, to Supernova was more of the same.
Well, it was too little too late in a lot of ways. If that had come out contemporaneous to when it should have come out,
yes,
like 3 years earlier,
yes,
it would have been a really big deal.
Yes.
I remember like going with Captain Spike, though, and we were like, oh, hey, Supernova just got added to Mobius Golfland, or they upgraded it, or whatever they did.
Well, they always should have done, and I said this on OLR a lot in the early years, they should have done a DDR 2DX, like they did Beatmania. And they should have either added extra panels, which technically they did in Solo.
For Solo, yeah.
Yeah, but that, I mean, that was kind of a different thing. Or maybe some limited hand motions or whatever. They should have found a way to, or add the center panel only or something, and really made the machine bigger, badder, better. And I think maybe that's what we were expecting out of Supernova, and it didn't really happen. It was more of the same. And one other thing I want to get out, I really feel like the series should have gone competitive at some point. You know, there was Step Battle in the very, very, very early Dance Dance Revolution mixes, like second mix, but there was nothing like, I don't know, like, why couldn't we have like a You Got Served moment on a DDR machine? Like, that wasn't really possible the way the game was constructed. So anyway, I could ramble for 3 more hours.
Well, a little side note I want to make is Dance Dance Revolution Mario mix. I thought that was really cute.
Tim, you seem to have something to say.
I do, and it's not a great thing to say, but in recent years I've played DDR. I've sort of gotten over myself. I can play it in an arcade. I've played it at home. We have it hooked up on the MAME cabinet. There's sort of two issues that I've always had with the game that have really prevented me from enjoying it and doing well at it, and I think they might be personal problems. But the first one is, The look of the game with the arrows on the screen, it's just, for some reason, my brain has a hard time parsing all of those arrows because they're all the same color. They're just sort of all up there, and it's a big sea of arrows. And I have a hard time translating that into the required movement. Like, my brain gets really confused with that easily. And the second thing is, there seems to be a lack of feedback. So I'll stomp on the thing at the right time, or what I think is the right time. I might miss it, I might not miss it, but the game doesn't really communicate to me whether or not I have.
You were early or late or any of that, right?
Yeah, I don't know. There wasn't like a sound.
You're supposed to get the great, 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 perfect, 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 marvelous, marvelous. That's what's supposed to come up on the screen.
Yeah, but those are big words, and those are hard to read when you're all trying to look at all these arrows.
That's true. I would say fiddle with the options when you start a song, because you can recolor the arrows by going into like solo mode. You can have the arrows scroll faster so that they break apart a little bit. Especially in some of the home mixes, you can change the coloring of the arrows, and a lot of that helps. And I don't see that as cheating at all.
I didn't know that. That's something
in the tournaments and stuff, people do that and change arrow speeds and what have you.
Sometimes that was the whole thing of the tournament, is that, oh, you got to play this song in reverse, you know, where the arrows scroll the other way. So there's boost mode, too, that makes it kind of go slow at first and speed up. You know, so play around with the options. You might find something you like better.
Cool. Yeah. I didn't know those options existed. I should probably
hold down the start button when you start a song.
Okay.
I do want to get back to what Sly Kick was saying and just talk about two licensed DDR games real quick, and then we're going to move on. And we're going to start clipping these discussions about individual games way shorter. I want to talk about Dance Dance Revolution Mario Mix and Dance Dance Revolution Disney's Rave.
Oh, I thought you were going to talk about True Kiss Destination. And those games were shit.
That
let's
would
be
honest. Game Boy appropriate, but they were awful.
Yeah,
we
that's
should
true.
Talk about that on Shit Games number 2.
We probably will. Why don't you tell us about Mario Mix?
Well, I mean, obviously, as a Nintendo fanboy...
What console did it come out on?
GameCube.
Continue.
And it had, you know, like a Mario-themed pad, so, you know, it was really cute. And I just, you know, it was just more DDR, but it had Mario, and I mean, that was cute.
Something that I thought was interesting was there wasn't much non-Nintendo licensed music. They mostly went with techno remixes of, like... open domain, like, classical music. Like, oh, it's a techno remix of a Tchaikovsky song.
That's what made that game niche and hard to find.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That is, I think that it was a huge missed opportunity, which, again, sort of the leitmotif of this discussion.
They corrected it on the Wii by giving games that were more in line with other DDR games.
And you know, there was like a, there was like
a copy
story to it. It was like,
was there really?
Yeah, there was like, oh, Waluigi stole the music keys. And you had to like go recover them.
Waluigi had a starring role. No wonder the game's niche and hard to find.
Right? Ain't nobody got time for that. You know what game did not have a story was Disney Rave. It just had some awesome Disney techno remixes and Night of Fire.
It's okay for the kid audience and to play at Disneyland. I think it's one of those things any DDR fan has to try at once, but it's not going to give you that big of a challenge. And it's just the way it's set up is really different.
I like it because it's the only DDR game I can play on the highest difficulty.
Because it's toned down for children.
That is literally the point, yes. Okay, moving on. You know, we had, after the huge blowout success of Dance Dance Revolution, you know, we talked a little bit about how it was this huge issue. It had initiatives from the U.S. government pushing this thing forward. There were some clones.
There were quite a few clones.
And some of these clones, what I think of as clones, are in their own right possibly just as popular as Dance Dance mm-hmm. Revolution, if not more so within their respective communities. I'm talking, of course, about games like Pump It Up, Stepping Stage.
Can we talk about Stepping Stage for a minute?
In the Groove is a big one. Did you just shake your head no?
Oh, well, I... maybe.
Were you knowing me?
No. I was not knowing you. I was knowing some of these games. Because he said, can we talk about Stepping Stage for a minute?
I want to talk about Stepping Stage because...
You have less than 40 seconds to talk about Stepping Stage. Go.
So Stepping Stage was not only really confusing to play, but it had the most terrible soundtrack of 70s to 90s pop covers, very Englishy, and the most terrible videos. And we're actually going to link you a playlist I compiled of videos I found on YouTube.
Here's my version. It was shit.
Thank you.
No, but seriously, watch the video playlist that we link on YouTube.
I actually
it's
have
hilarious.
The PS2 version of this. After we talked about it online one afternoon, I was like, what? And then I looked at my collection, and I literally have a copy of this that I didn't even know I owned. So we could probably make our own videos.
In the Groove specifically said a lot about DDR fandom in the U.S. because basically In the Groove was a fan game made out of DDR.
And that was Red Octane who
funded it, basically.
Funded it, yeah.
And the lack of DDR in the U.S. and what happened after Extreme, this is why In the Groove happened.
Let's talk about In the Groove right now because this is a huge talking point. We may skip over a couple of these other games. Mm-hmm. But In the Groove, I think, is a big one because a lot of people who are coming into these games in this scene in the last few years are probably more familiar with In the Groove than they are even with Dance Dance Revolution.
Which is weird because Konami, basically, as part of the settlement, owns it now, which is interesting to me. And I don't know, my head's kind of back in the day when this game first came out, and I think a lot of the In the Groove community were really stuck up. I'm sorry. That was just my opinion. They kind of would say the game was a lot better than I think it really was.
I dated a guy who was into it, and I agree with you that's an accurate read.
Here's the thing, is that there just was not the admission that, you know what, it's DDR. Yes, they added mines. Yes, the songs are different. It's fucking DDR. And until you can admit that, you're going to sound like a pompous ass.
Yes, thank you.
It is definitely an evolution of DDR. It is a direct response to Konami's failure to keep DDR going.
Mm-hmm.
And I respect it for that. And I respect the makers for that. And especially the guys who, like Kyle Ward, probably wrote half the soundtrack himself. I respect him for doing that, you know, but at the end of the day, it was kind of like, but this is what American audiences want. This is like an Americanized version of how Japan does DDR.
Yes.
I always thought the interesting thing about In the Groove, and I always think of Get Into the Groove, but is that the engine for it was based on Stepmania, which was the open source DDR mm-hmm. thing. And then we didn't really talk about Pump It Up.
I have a lot of negative feelings about Stepmania because even though I feel like probably there's a lot of really legitimate uses for it, I feel like most people just use it for DDR piracy.
That sucks.
It's very true.
Which, I mean, in this day and age now, it's like, okay, whatever. But at the time, it mm-hmm. was really difficult to hear people talk about why would I go play that DDR game that just came out and is brand new? I have that at home already.
Yeah.
Because playing with your fingers isn't the same. That's not Dance Dance Revolution. That's Button Mash Revolution.
Thank you.
It's BBR.
Like, you might BBR. As well be playing the original Game Boy port of Dance Dance Revolution.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
I think the only other talking point I would have on Pump It Up and In the Groove is that they both were involved with Konami lawsuits that were settled outside of court. And then the interesting is that the In the Groove team teamed up with Andamiro, who was the Pump It Up group, and they did Pump It Up Pro.
Mm-hmm. I have, in my life, only ever known one person who was really passionate about Pump, but he was really passionate about Pump.
Don't underestimate how popular Pump It Up is.
Well, that's what I meant. He was super passionate, so I don't doubt.
Well, it's not just so much that, but like in Korea, it was legit a huge thing. Like the big tournaments... I mean, like, you know, like I don't know about stadium size, but like,
it's
you
like
know,
e-sports.
Giant hall size tournaments. Like, it's a legit sport.
Are they considered professional athletes?
But for some reason, it didn't translate over here the way the DDR did. And I think that's just K-pop versus J-pop.
Which,
I don't want to start that war, but just for whatever reason, I think J-pop caught on over here.
Yeah,
the way
but ironically,
K-pop did.
I wonder if.
Amusingly,
they...
K-pop now yeah. is catching on.
Isn't that yeah. funny? Yeah, no.
I mean, I'm a big fan of both. But
so Pump It Up was just ahead of its time.
Okay. Well, you know, center
that's one
panel
way to look at
all,
it.
A
it.
Lot of the songs do kick ass. Go back and listen to them now.
Mm. I think that would probably be true. Interesting.
Was there a sense of if you were big in the DDR community that, oh, no, don't go play Pump It Up? Or was it like considered?
No. I think Pump It Up was more respected. In that, I mean, I think people realize, oh, Pump It Up's like your K-pop game. It's a little funky because of the arrows in the center and it's diagonal and all that. But Pump It Up also had a reputation for being a lot harder.
We have three more games to discuss in the Bimani section. These are 2003's Karaoke Revolution, 2007's Jubeat, and 2010's
U-Beat.
Dance Masters.
Careful, the J is silent. Jubeat.
Oh gosh, you're right.
I don't want it to sound like something else.
You beat the game. Get it?
Oh, yay. That's delightful and happy. Let's get these out in order of swiftness. Who here has played a U-Beat arcade machine?
Not an arcade machine, but of course there's that iPad app.
Question I was going to say, who has played the iPad version?
I didn't even know there was an
Lethal
iPad
Enforcers.
U-Beat.
Mm-hmm.
Don't bother
on your iPhone. The screen's too small.
Yeah, don't. It's cool, though. It's a pleasant little diversion. Mm-hmm. I'm happy that I played it, and if I ever see it in an arcade, I will play it.
I never really knew a lot about U-Beat. I never played U-Beat, obviously. I couldn't find a lot of information about U-Beat. Can you just, in a couple words, describe it?
Imagine a 4x4 grid, and the icons will light up. It's literally whack-a-mole.
Yes.
Literally whack-a-mole, but like a, you know, beat-matching version of it. The one thing I find kind of difficult about U-Beat is I really find, because they'll play this little video, like it doesn't just change color and you tap it, like it plays a little video that counts down to when you tap it.
Yes.
And for me, that's really kind of hard to get the hang of.
Yeah. Yeah. Dance Masters. This was, of course, a Kinect product launched against...
Harmonix's
Dance Central. Wow, again, I see a recurring
theme. Do you know what we totally neglected to talk about that I would like to just take 1 minute to talk about that will lead up into this?
Sir, go. Yes, sir.
Dance Maniacs and Paradise.
I didn't neglect it. I skipped it, but go.
They're fun. They're hand motion, body motion sorts of things. Really, I had a good time with both. There was at Milpitas Golfland a... Dance Maniacs and a Para-Para machine right next to each other.
Para-Para Paradise, or Para-Para Paradise, or whatever you want to call it, was really kind of the cult Bimani game.
Yes.
And like
Dr. Sakura loves that, right?
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, there's people to do. And that's the one where it's like it's country line dancing with your hands to Eurobeat. That's what Para-Para is, basically. And, you know, there used to be this group of guys at Milpitas Golfland that would all get together and kind of do it. Because the big thing people would do...
People
would do the shadowing of the dances because that's what happens in the clubs. Except it's like a very female heavy thing in Japan. Para-para
yes.
girls. There's no para-para boys. I mean, which,
unfortunately.
You know, gender norms, fuck that shit, right? You know, and all
Thank
that.
Thank you.
But
we are all about that here.
But, you know, it is still amusing in that regard that probably a lot of these guys that were into it had no idea that it was, you know, a very cheerleaderish
feminine thing.
Yes. But, you know, again.
Fuck gender norms.
That's right. Not trying to say it was a bad thing. It was just an amusing thing.
Okay, Slapkick. It was appropriate for you to bring that up. Well done.
Well, because I just thought because they were early examples of using motion sensors in rhythm gaming.
So, okay, Konami took that to the next step with Dance Masters, which launched against the extremely more successful Dance Central. Who here actually bought Dance Masters or played it?
I didn't even buy it. Oh, I played it. I borrowed it from somebody.
I have never played it, so why don't you tell us about it?
It is somewhat... The difference between Dance Masters and Dance Central is that Dance Masters is about hitting these icons on the screen. It's like Elite Beat Agents with your hands.
Yeah, I thought it was like a full body Undone.
But you also would do movements, like you have these shadow movements that you can kind of line up with. And so it was great for Para Para, and there was only... I mean, everybody says, oh, it's basically Para Para Paradise for the Kinect. No, because there's only two Para Para songs in the whole game, but it was kind of like they would bring that to other songs. But again, here's where the game flopsied. It's like all Konami original songs. Not that that's necessarily bad, but when you're sitting on the shelf next to Dance Central, where you can play Lady Gaga and, you know, all the stuff that people are dancing to in clubs and learn an actual choreographed dance to those songs, Konami, Man-eater. You didn't understand the U.S. audience yet again.
Although, absolutely. With the spinoff Rhythm Party, which was Boom Boom Dance in Japan...
I think Rhythm Party was really underestimated. Again,
I actually really like that game.
It feels like one of those games that was an idea that they, but then they kind of stopped it and they put that out. But it wasn't.
It has new Vanilla Ice songs.
It wasn't terrible, and it had Born This Way, and you know, it had some interesting selections. I think that if that had been a disc based game for like $20-$30, I think it would have seen a lot more success, but it got lost in Xbox Live Arcade.
If that had been released rather than Dance Masters, I actually think it could have been very successful.
Absolutely. And it's so weird to me that then Konami just kind of puts that out and puts out some DLC and forgets about it. I'm like, this is the better game.
Yeah, this is the game that could have been very successful.
I prefer Rhythm Party to Dance Central, which for I mean, what little I can get out of it with its abbreviated song list.
I actually really enjoyed that game as well, and I really enjoyed how analog the game was compared to other rhythm games. Many rhythm games have a very digital, like, you have to hit the note at this exact time, and it's just, you know, click the button or hit the button or step on the pad. But this was allowed for a little bit of improvisation. It allowed for you to do whatever type of movements you wanted. All you needed to do is have your hands in this region or make this particular gesture, and you were free to do.
It's like, if I want to shake my booty while I'm doing
it's important to say you were rewarded for that. Like a note that you would usually hit with your right hand, if you actually did a crossover and hit it with your left hand, you got bonus points.
Yeah.
So you were rewarded for that type of stuff, which made the game very unique. Yeah. And cool.
It's like, I'm going to spin around to get to this other side.
And jump and moving in motion. It even could see you kind of swaying to the
beat.
Just
was such a lost opportunity, I think.
Yeah. I really enjoyed the systems, but the meager selection of songs that I enjoyed was what killed it
for me. And that seems to be Konami's trend here, kind of what you're saying. At least, and I mean, that's because, I mean, Bimani is still, I mean, I know it's still active in Japan, but I mean, I don't know how, if it's quite like what it was before. Is it still as popular?
It's still, they're still making games, but
which I guess is more than they can say than what they're really doing over here, but
all right, well, I think that about wraps it up for our discussion on Bimani. We have two more discussion points here, and I'm issuing a 5-minute challenge on each of these. We have gone on far too long as it is. There is no way we can possibly take this long moving forward. So for each of these discussion points, 5 minutes. So we are going to take a 5-minute discussion on the Plastic Instrument Wars. Is everyone ready for this challenge?
Let's try it. I mean, I think the thing is that... the Plastic Instrument Roars really about oversaturation.
I think that's a yes.
Thank you. Right? Thank you. Holy crap.
He's just trying to get some in before you start the timer.
I
am literally setting a timer. That is what
I
we
was
have
trying
to
help us streamline it by saying that, you know, there's not really a lot to say about Guitar Hero, Metallica, Van Halen, etc. Aside from the fact that it was, you know...
I agree, but that's also part of the discussion that takes place after I start the timer, which I still have not done. You're still
okay,
doing
start
it.
The timer.
All right, starting now. 5 minutes. Plastic Instrument Wars, 2005 to 2010. Part 4 of our discussion. Go.
So it started with Guitar Hero for the PS2. It was Harmonix and Red Octane. You know, it was Guitar Freaks inspired... And it was a hard rock soundtrack. They didn't really expect it to take off, but it was huge. Guitar Hero 2 came out later. Guitar Hero Rocks the 80s
was
also developed by Harmonix. Was also developed by Harmonix.
And then, of course, the big turning point was when Activision bought out Red Octane in 2006. Harmonix was bought out by MTV Games, and that's what caused the big split. And we saw that with Guitar Hero 3 and Rock Band, which were within a month of each other, I believe.
Show of hands, or I guess volunteer your voice, who in this room owned a copy of Guitar Hero or Guitar Hero 2?
I had both.
Both.
We absolutely. We were the first. We got to play a preview copy on the news.
Excellent. Tim, had you previously played any of these plastic instrument games before that?
No. I did Guitar Hero first.
So complete virgin up to Guitar
Hero.
Same
here.
Correct.
My first time.
What did you have to say? I will get to you. What did you have to say about the game? How did you feel about it as an experience for your first time with this genre?
Well, thinking about it, I have got some mixed emotions because it was kind of a I had a love-hate relationship with it, and it was. I got really, really into it for a hot minute, and then there were like sort of two big things that really killed it for me.
What were those two things?
One of them was the oversaturation, which Slapkick has already mentioned. There were just so many games, and they just shoved in your face, and I was just like, I'm done with this. The other one was, as opposed to other rhythm games, this was more of a instrument emulation game. It's like you're emulating playing a guitar or emulating playing a keyboard, but I really like playing actual music, and so while I was having fun playing these rhythm games, at the same time I was like, "This is trying really hard to make you feel like you're playing a guitar." And I think I'd rather be playing a guitar.
Did you find that playing drums was the most fun for you because
when Rock Band came out, I was always wanting to play the drums because you actually were playing drums.
An important thing when we get to Rock Band in a minute. I just want to say that my first Guitar Hero experience was up here in Sacramento at one of the older versions of OLR Studios, although I guess that might have not been OLR Studios, huh? Because that was Dark Sakura's place before. Mm-hmm. But it was at Rob Roberts' old apartment.
All right, so obviously what happened here, we had Red Octane, we had Harmonix. They split off into two different directions. Red Octane, as we know, ended up going down the cash cow milking line that Activision, bought them for, paired them up with, Neversoft and, a bunch of other studios that they already had. And they basically made, over the course of these 5 years, they made, something like 8 or 9 Guitar Hero games. Mm-hmm. They made games for the DS. They made games for, anywhere that they could have them. They made crappy little peripherals for the DS. Mm-hmm. Harmonix went away that I thought was a little more pure. They went more for like a one-to-one simulation. They did before Red Octane / Neversoft did. They were doing vocal performances in this mm-hmm. game, doing like the whole band setup so that you're doing session play like you were doing in Guitar Freaks, Drum Mania, as we were discussing earlier. Harmonix used the very engine that they had developed for Konami mm-hmm. for Karaoke Revolution, yeah. as we discussed earlier. They literally took all of the disparate pieces that Konami developed for this genre and made a compelling, complete experience to the point where for drums, for most songs, you are effectively just playing the drums uh-huh. for this song.
Yeah.
For vocals, if you're on expert, no, you're just singing this song. You're performing uh-huh. real music. How did this affect your experience with this genre, Tim?
Well, that's what I enjoyed about those last few games I was playing before I stopped completely, because I was I didn't have a drum kit. I never really played the drums before, and it sort of taught me how to play the drums. And that was cool. And but still, it was digital. It was you either hit it on time or you didn't. Same with the singing. You either hit the exact note or you didn't. But the thing about performing in music is,
You felt there was no room for improvisation or breaking from...
Yeah, you couldn't. There was nothing about your own personal style. There was nothing. It was just copy this exactly. And that doesn't really, it's not really playing music.
Rob, coming at you with this from a different perspective, you, like myself, had experience with these very pure Japanese, super tight timing windows, very digital, to borrow Tim's buzzword, experiences. How did you feel looking at this very polished, very complete package made for U.S. audiences, lots of music you probably heard on the radio throughout mm-hmm. your life,
they gave people what they wanted. Harmonix understands how to make a good music game, and I will always support whatever they do because they know what the heck they're doing. Mm-hmm. And they really struck gold with this. And notice when they left Guitar Hero was really when the franchise started to go down the toilet in some ways. And, you know, sorry to them trying to pump out all the Guitar Hero games. Not that Rock Band was any stranger to that. Well, we got the Beatles Rock Band, which, but it's the Beatles.
That
it's
is
the
about Beatles the most amazing thing you could possibly do with that
as
license.
Compared to Van Halen and Metallica.
But
no
they also had, come
too.
On, they had,
they
the
had Green Day.
They had Lego, they had Green Day, so they weren't a stranger to making all those games too, but there was
I'm
a certain
stranger to love.
There was a certain quality in those games, notably the Beatles one, that you just don't find in Guitar Hero Metallica.
I always feel that Activision
I will let
was
you finish.
Playing.
We have crossed our 5-minute line, which means we're wrapping up this thought so that we can get to the next discussion point, but complete your thought.
I always felt like that Activision was always playing catch-up, and that's kind of just like what really kind of did them in at the end. Yeah. Not Activision, but the Guitar Hero franchise.
Well, I think it's real interesting to consider that Activision, of course, went where they thought the money was, which is, you know, Red Octane, who, as we had mentioned earlier, had built a name for themselves and a fan base for themselves, making these, I don't mean to say rip-off peripherals, but as shorthand, rip-off peripherals of what Konami was putting out for their games in Japan.
Mm-hmm. Can I say real quick, though, I know we're past the line, but since it's not on your list anywhere, Activision did make DJ Hero, which I thought...
I actually love that game.
It was, you know, and a lot of people wrote it off as, oh, they're knocking off Beatmania, da-da-da, but, like, literally the mashups in that game alone were
so good,
and it's worth a look, and it's a bummer that game kind of flops.
It was on there, it was in the
But Activision did that to themselves.
I own two pads for that game and both of the games. I was a real strong believer in that. I was disappointed that DJ Hero 3DS got canceled.
DJ Hero did not flop because of DJ Hero. DJ Hero flopped because of Guitar Hero and Band Hero.
Yeah. No, it absolutely did. Mm. Unfortunately, the market just got too saturated, and Harmonix, even earlier this year, here in 2013, finally ended the weekly stream of Rock Band DLC.
Kings of DLC.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah,
every week
really
for like 5 years, new songs, some really incredible songs, some questionable songs, but always songs. Like
you
they were always there.
You can't be upset about their support of DLC.
Yeah. No, I thought they did it perfectly. I thought that their entire pipeline was incredible, and I remain impressed by how they
I have one
that.
Last thing to say about Harmonix, even though we've gone over the point.
Okay, then this is your last thing you're saying on this
is
topic,
that
and then
I
we're
think
moving
that
forward.
The smart decision they made is they, like we talked about earlier, Dance Central, they really kind of focused in on that, and that's, I think, what really saved them. You know, and to the point where the Kinect version of Just Dance is really trying to imitate it. So, you know, they kind of, Harmonix saw that the dance games, like Dance Just Dance, were kind of where it was going. And that's really what I think helped save them. Because Dance Central 2
well, that,
did
that
really
they
well.
They just got a judgment in their favor against their former employee, Viacom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, that's why Harmonix is doing okay and why we haven't seen any Guitar Hero games.
All right, now let's look at where things currently are in this marketplace. We're going to have another 5-minute time limit. I am getting my timer ready right now. Obviously, this is a loose time limit, but I will not be as loose as I just was. I just didn't want to cut anyone off mid-sentence. That would have been super rude. Section 5, rhythm platformers, a potential return to innovation, and looking toward the future, 2008 to the present. Tim, would you like to start it off? Tell me what you think about Wii Music for the Wii by Nintendo, 2008.
Oh, Wii Music. I didn't really have a great time with Wii Music.
Why not?
HD lag?
it wasn't an issue of HD lag. It was waggle. It was waggle your thing, and music came out.
Hey.
Okay, that sounded really bad. No. There was nothing compelling about it. I
think one important thing about it is that even if it didn't quite succeed as to what...
It did give us all kinds of memes.
As to what its original vision might have been. But I think that it kind of... Instead of being like, oh, super serious, Guitar Hero, blah, 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 it was just about, hey, have fun, waggle, and make music. So even if it didn't end up being fun for you, it was kind of more lighthearted.
I never felt like I was making music, though. I felt like I was just waggling my controller and the thing was playing, and it would be the same thing based on what, you know. Or, you know, you can switch the instruments, but that's about it.
It was definitely not a $50 game for me.
Slagkick, why don't you tell me a little bit about 2009's Major Minor's Majestic March?
I thought it was a big flop.
Kind of, okay, but tell me about the game.
For the reasons that that Tim didn't like Wii Music, it was a Nana Onsha game developed by Masaya Matsura and Rodney Greenblatt, the team behind Parappa and Jammer Lammy. And it was about your major, minor, you're leading a marching band, but I just found the controls were broken. And, you know, it just was not fun. Like, it just lacked what was so quirky and weird about Parappa and Lammy. So,
well, how about you tell me about the Bit Trip series up to and including Runner 2, which is not Bit Trip, strictly speaking, but is a continuation of the series.
Well, what I think is really cool is what Gaijin Games did is they made, like, just these different types of games. There was Bit Trip Beat, which was, like, a Pong-style game, and then Bit Trip Core, Bit Trip Void, and, of course, I think one of our most favorites here at Game Buoy is Bit Trip Runner, which was the rhythm platformer. And, you know, then there was Bit Trip Fate, which was the rhythm shoot 'em up, and Bit Trip Flux, which was kind of just an all-encompassing version. And, you know, they were on Steam, 3DS eShop, so you really should play them. They're just amazing games.
Bit Trip Runner 2 is, I think,
Future Legend of Rhythm Alien, which I can't say, but yeah.
And they have trading cards on Steam now, so even more incentive.
Excellent. And I'm happy that you chimed in, because I'd really like you to tell me about your experiences with Sound Shapes.
Sound Shapes is really cool because it's a Vita and PlayStation 3, not mm-hmm. at the same time, but it's a really good value because you get on one and the other. It's a little bit more of a platformer, but you mm-hmm. know Sony's really big on the whole play, create, share, do your own thing. So it was a really cool kind of you could create your own levels. Although, because of the fact you had all these very distinct looks in the game from the Dead Mouse stages, the Beck, a lot of the fan-made stages look a little bit like barf because it's just
well, yeah.
But you know what, I still applaud the attempt to kind of bring the play, create, share thing to a music game.
Well, it's really exciting to me that you brought up that it was more of a rhythm platformer, because that's something that in structuring this episode Slackkick and I discussed, that a lot of the current direction of rhythm games is less straight up simulating and emulating the experience of creating music, and more of let's have wider, broader entertainment experiences within the realm of this sort of rhythm framework. Sound Shapes, as you discuss, is one. Another big one that came out earlier this year was Game Freak's Harmonite.
Yeah.
Does anyone here have any experience with that?
It's so much fun. It's really cute.
It is an adorable game. And yeah, there's so much more, like, you know, you start to learn, like, wait a minute, can I go back and play this stage and get more points? Because I didn't realize I could do this the first time.
Yeah.
And, you know, Bit Trip Runner 2 does that a little bit, too.
Yeah.
So, you know.
I just have to say, on Sound Shapes, some of those Beck songs are, like, just some of the most amazing experiences I've
ever
had with
a rhythm
platformer.
Only forward, never back. We are running out of time. Does anyone have anything to say about the new Fantasia project? Because that's really the high note to hit about the current state of rhythm gaming.
I can't say anything about it because I wasn't invited to E3 to play it.
Rude bitches.
Yay, Disney. I think it's really clever. I hope Harmonix has a success with it.
Tim, you looked like you had something to say under the wire.
Not about Fantasia, but one thing about rhythm platforming that's not on your list, and that's the new Rayman Legends game. It's not out yet, but they have a number of stages which are rhythm platforming based, and they're really, really enjoyable.
Yeah, very true.
Really great experiences.
I was reminded of Bit Trip Runner when I played that. Yeah.
Excellent. Slykick, why don't you wrap this up? Tell us about Fantasia. Pitch it to us. You have like 10 seconds. Go.
It's going to be Kinect, doing Fantasia with your hands, pop hits, top 40, and, you know, just making music and visual experiences as per the Fantasia kind of culture.
Yeah, so I think it's interesting. My understanding is that it's the new iteration of Disney's long-running musical exploration series, you know, previously done in these film form and short films, 2000... what have you.
Well, Fantasia was always meant to be an ongoing thing. Like,
yes.
Hence why they did the movie in the year 2000, which was like the original but different. That was Walt Disney's vision. So this is a really interesting way to kind of take that to a new generation and a new kind of platform for that. It's exciting. And at the end of the day, it's Harmonix.
Well,
it's going to be good.
That's, to me, why this is really the note to end that part of this discussion on, is because, again, we see Harmonix stepping up. They were there at sort of the beginning of this becoming a real thing. They were there at the prime of it. They were, as we discussed, of the two groups really pushing forward rhythm gaming there in the mid-2000s or aughts, I guess you would say. They were really the ones that most people stuck with and were like, these people have art, they have vision, they are really trying to make something special continue to happen, doing Beatles games. I think it's really fascinating that Disney went with them and said, this is the new evolution of this musical project. Which is the perfect note here. Everyone is going to have a chance here at the round table. I am going to time you. I'm not going to tell you how long you have. Make your argument count enough that I don't want to cut you off. What do you think about the genre overall, what we have discussed today, looking back, and where would you like to see this genre of game go? I'm going to start with Slagkick.
So you can cut me off immediately, right?
Exactly so. Set up the rules for our guests.
Looking back, I miss the Rock Band sort of thing. I hope that we see it again in the future, which is kind of looking in the future. I'm glad that we are seeing because this is kind of looking back and where it's going. I'm glad that we're kind of seeing like the quirkiness come back that we saw back in the late 90s with Space Channel 5 and that sort of crazy stuff. I'm Jammer Lammy, Parappa. And we're kind of seeing that revisited in, like, these sound shapes, Harmonite, just these kind of, like, cute, quirky, fun experiences, Bit Trip Runner. And, you know, I'm just really hopeful that we're going to continue seeing more innovation. And then, you know, maybe we can see a return to some of the other things that we liked in the past. Like, you know, maybe Bimani will finally do something right.
Excellent. You ended at the exact perfect time. Well
like
played.
45 seconds.
Well done. No, you were more than a minute. Tim?
Well,
same question.
Well, I like how rhythm games have been a little bit more innovative lately, things like sound shapes and the rhythm platformers. And I really hope that people continue to innovate and find new ways to merge gameplay and rhythm. And I'm going to contradict Slagkick. I hope they don't go back to instrument emulation, because I think that has limited value and has been done quite a bit. So I'm looking forward to seeing what devs you know can come up with next that's new. That's it. I know that's like half
my
time.
Can I ask Tim one question?
It really was like half your time, so yes, you may Slagkick.
I'm just curious, did you think that Rock Band 3 with the Pro Guitar, do you think that that was successful at all?
I've never played it. Actually,
the same thing that the Rocksmith direction was, and I would love to have talked about all of this, but you know, obviously what we scheduled is one episode should have been two or three. So
okay,
brilliant. Maybe we will revisit this in a micro episode in the future. That having been said, Tim has finished his segment, and it is time for the princess.
I'll honestly try to keep it short. As far as like what I miss the arcade. I miss the community. I miss that. That's gone now, and that's what I miss terribly. And I'm not sure if that can be brought back. I hope there is some type of phenomenon. But if I knew where these things were going to go that I would enjoy, I would have made that game, and I'd be a millionaire. So I just, you know, don't forget fun. Don't forget your audience. That's really it. That's all I can say. Shortly and succinctly, that's what I can say.
Brilliant. That was a superb answer. Did you have something to say?
Yeah, I think somebody really needs to make that fake ninja rhythm game from the Scott Pilgrim movie.
I would play that, yeah.
And I just have to say that I want Lara Croft's Kinect Dance Party.
I don't think that's going to happen. I really don't.
Yes,
but, you know, I'll pitch it.
The Star Wars Kinect thing. Oh. That's like exactly where music games do not need to go. No more Kinect dance games.
So I have three things I'd like to see happen in the future, because this ties into basically what everyone said. I would really like to see a return of band emulation. You know, I know very specifically that Tim said that he did not want that. I do miss that. I used to throw really great Rock Band parties, and I'd like to do so again in the future. That having been said, I agree with Tim, because I really do wish that we could see a lot of innovation here. I'd really like to see more games taking this really cool new direction that we've seen Harmonite, Fantasia. We're seeing Sound Shapes take, where people aren't just doing one-to-one button, pretend you're playing a guitar, but interface with this rhythm and with these musical elements in new and interesting ways that enhance already existent and, you know, currently unseen gameplay experiences. And third and final, I agree with Rob. I would really like to see a showpiece of some kind. If not in the arcade, then at least something that I could invite people to my apartment to play and have it be an event again. I miss community. I miss these music games being an event.
Yeah, like 40 people coming over for a karaoke revolution.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, which would be Rock Band to some extent, but now that Rock Band is kind of done, we don't need more of the same. What's going to be that next thing?
I wouldn't mind more of the same if they took it to a new place, but I guess really the past is past and that is done. I don't know that you could throw a Rock Band party in 2013 and still have it be a novel big deal. And with that having been said, unless anyone has any questions, concerns, or last-minute additions, I think it's time for Rob to get his shout-out opportunity.
Well, you gave me plenty of time at the beginning of the show, so I'll just say again, you know, Orange Lounge Radio, Horde House, and VogNetwork.com, and just, you know, support indie broadcasting.
Support
guys who work hard to do their show every week, especially these two guys here have worked very hard on Game Buoy, and I'm very proud of you boys, so... Congrats on a job well done.
I'm having feels.
I'm going to plug Game Buoy because it's a great show.
Aww. Tim, do you have anything to plug?
I suppose so. I guess I do work for Crystal Dynamics, so I'm required to plug Tomb Raider. Go buy it. It's a great game. It's good. I think everybody here has played it.
I am not saying this just because I know you. I actually thought that game was really quite tremendous.
Excellent. Thank you. And I guess since this is a music episode... I am involved with the San Francisco Mandolin Orchestra. If you're in the Bay Area, San Francisco, or anywhere nearby, go to sfmandolin.org. They have concerts every few months, and we do a lot of different selections of classical and different classical
theme. I love the time that you guys did a version of Tarkus.
We did do a crazy British invasion season, and we did do a mandolin orchestra arrangement of Tarkus by Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, which is as weird as it sounds.
which is a very Final Fantasy battle theme.
I suppose so, yeah.
I want to say, Rob, thank you so much for spending this beautiful, sunny summer Sunday in Sacramento with us here in the Orange Lounge Radio studio, letting us record here, use your space, take up your entire day before you record your own show. You have been a tremendous host. Thank you so much for taking this afternoon with us to talk about this today.
Thank you for having me on what is clearly your longest show ever, but I hope y'all enjoyed it.
Tim, thank you so much for coming out. Thank you for wasting your time here with us. I say wasting, I mean spending. It has been tremendous fun. I have learned a ton talking with Rob and talking with you. I cannot think of two awesomer guests than the two of you have been today.
Well, thanks for having me as your emergency replacement guest. It was a lot of fun.
Excellent. I'm happy that you enjoyed it.
And I guess I kind of had to because I'm your ride.
You didn't have to. You could have sat in the corner and played 9 hours, nine persons, nine doors.
It's very, very much a Game Buoy title.
Yeah, but thanks for having me on. I love fun.
Thank you. Of course, to everyone out there in Internet Radio Land, you're already listening to us. But if somehow you don't know where you found us, please load up GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
Unless you have anything to say, Sly Kick, I think it's time to close doors right now.
Yep.
Excellent. With that, keep gaming, keep thinking, and both of you dance like you want to win.
We already used that one.
Like the flames in hell. Close up that